Okay, it looks like we're good to start.
Are we public yet?
Yes, we are. We're
Okay.
broadcasting.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. This is the monthly meeting of East Bay Community Energy Board of Directors. Thank you for those who are joining us as attendees. I see more attendees are coming in, including a few staff and such. We are, as was advertised on the agenda, we are starting with a closed session. So, Madam Clerk, I'm going to ask that we take the roll. Is that the appropriate next step?
Yes,
and
correct.
After we take the roll, we can adjourn into closed session, and then we'll come back out as soon as possible.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I can see that directors from Albany, Fremont, and Pleasanton are still in the Hangout, so I will call them as present.
Okay.
Berkeley. Dublin. Fremont is here. Hayward.
Here.
Livermore.
Here.
Newark.
Here.
Piedmont. Pleasanton is present. San Leandro.
Present.
Tracy. Union City. Community Advisory Committee.
Present.
Thank you. And you do have a quorum.
Okay.
And Director Martinez is also on the line.
Yes. You didn't call my name.
Oh, I apologize. I moved you to the end. Alameda County.
Here.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank
and
you.
And Dublin has joined through closed session. So Dublin is also present.
Okay, great. Okay. So we have a quorum. Is that correct? I'm sorry? I think she's going to the...
Yes, you do have a quorum.
Great. Okay. So thank you all for attending. And to the attendees, as was advertised, we are going to adjourn now into closed session, and we will be back as soon as we can. So we will now adjourn into closed session. Thank you.
Is that AK, the Hangout Room?
Yes, correct.
The whatever that's called. Okay, people are compiling back in slowly here.
Sorry about that. I got booted off and couldn't get back in. So I trust everything went well.
Oh, did someone get lost out of closed session?
That would be Trish, yes.
Oh, sorry about that, Trish. Yes, everything's all good. Thank you.
All right, someone will catch me up.
Yeah. We allocated all the additional new workload to Livermore, if that's okay.
Well, you know, we don't have anything else going on here. It's all good. It's all good. I know what happens when you're not present in places.
All right. Okay, hold on. Just getting this up here. Okay. Inder, anything to report out of closed session formally?
Good evening, Chair and members of the board. Nothing to report out of closed session tonight.
Thank you very much. There may be some other information coming up later in the meeting. And Madam Clerk, now we will call for the general public comment. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And I have okay. Blair Beekman.
Hi, thank you. Welcome back. I've been eagerly waiting for your return to the public meeting process, and thanks. I've explained I'm originally from San Jose. San Jose, interestingly, has been working on their own community energy ideas a lot in the past month, and they've been on their council agendas a lot the past month. And you know, they're coming up with working with PG&E on local storage ideas that can store solar. I think using natural gas. And it's called Hummingbird Energy, and it's a concept I suggest you look into as a reference for yourselves. And it's long-term as ideas of storage that I think is of interest to people from the CAC meeting a couple of days ago from community persons. I wanted to thank yourself for the meeting minutes process and how you write out your meeting minutes and really describe in two sentences, maybe three, what a person says during a council meeting. I'm assuming that's either a committee meeting. That is either the public or perhaps it can work for commission members themselves as well. And finally, at the CAC meeting on Monday, I have places to go today. I've got three meetings I got to balance around tonight. I hope you can allow me a bit of space at this time. That at the CAC meeting on Monday, I think we talked about in item six tonight, that you have decisions to make about this upcoming year, next year, about how to use Bright 100 and nuclear energy. And you only have a month to really work on it. And I hope the community here in the East Bay can really get involved with, how we can avoid nuclear as much as possible. And in fact, at the CAC meeting, I wanted to note that the staff presenter on the subject, she tried to present that if we can work towards ideas of how to end nuclear, she's totally in favor of that. And she seemed to be geared to want to work that way too. And it's just a matter of that we just need the will to do that and time and energy to figure out good plans. So thank you for your time today. And thank you that you're back. And good luck on the meeting tonight. Thanks.
There are no more speakers for public comment.
Okay, thank you, Madam Clerk. Okay, we're going to go to our agenda. The next item on the agenda is our consent agenda. There are five items on the consent agenda, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11.
That's six items.
It has been moved. If I hear a second to move the consent items?
Second.
Okay, any discussions or questions about any of the consent items among the board members first? I'm not seeing any hand raised or anybody waving in the camera. Do we have any, Madam Clerk, any speakers on the consent agenda?
We do not have speakers on the consent agenda. Okay. I apologize. Sorry. I do have Blair Beekman and Barbara Stebbins and Seda Dumas for item 9.
Okay. Did I see that? I see Mayor May is in the attendee list. Do we need to move her over to the panelist list?
Okay. She's been promoted to panelist.
Great. Good. Okay, and we have one speaker, go ahead.
Okay, Barbara Stebbins, Seda, if you could please raise your hands. I'm unmuting Jada first.
Hi, thanks, Stephanie. Hi, I'm Jada Durmaz-Doyan with Local Clean Energy Alliance and East Bay Clean Power Alliance. I appreciate your efforts around pay-for-performance, energy efficiency, and these pilot projects. Hopefully, we will see more of these in the future. And I've seen the request for qualifications, and I'm glad you already mentioned that vendors who are located in the East Bay Community Energy Service area may be placed on a qualified vendor list. I hope EBC will prioritize working with local vendors when they make the selection, because one of the goals we would like to achieve through these programs is to create local jobs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Barbara, your microphone is unmuted. There it goes.
Great. Actually,
We lost you.
Sorry.
There you are.
There.
Yes. Anyway, all I'm doing is passing because Jada actually said pretty much everything I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you, Barbara.
Yeah.
Okay, Blair, you're unmuted.
Hi, I pass as well. The first speaker said things needed to be said. Thank you.
Great, thank you. There are no more speakers.
All for the comment, and we have a motion and a second for the entire consent agenda. Seeing no other board members with questions, could we take the roll call vote on that, please?
Sure. Albany?
Yes.
Berkeley?
Yes.
Dublin?
Yes.
Fremont?
Yes.
Livermore?
Yes.
Newark?
Yes.
Piedmont? Pleasanton?
Yes.
San Leandro?
Yes.
Tracy?
Yes.
Union City? Has not joined yet. Emeryville?
Yes.
Oakland?
Aye.
Thank you. Motion passes.
So Hayward is also a yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Alameda County would be a yes too.
Yes,
I know I'm leaving in January, but I'm still here.
Okay, I didn't ask because you moved and seconded it.
Yes.
But I will ask the next time, yes.
That's fair.
Okay, thank you very much for that. So now we will move on to the to Nick's CEO report and the items under there. Nick?
Yes. Okay, great. So first on our committees, so we held, why is this not, sorry, I'm just having some minor technical difficulties on my end. Let me just do one thing. On our committees, we did hold an executive committee meeting in July. And we did not hold an executive committee, nor did we hold one in August. We did hold a finance, administration, and procurement subcommittee meeting just last Friday. And that meeting, there was a focus on two of the items on tonight's agenda. One is the GASB account. And the other was the energy prepayment. We did have a marketing, regulatory, and legislative subcommittee meeting in August, focused on general review of regulatory and legislative items. The September meeting was canceled due to staff need to, especially on the legislative and regulatory, well, legislative in particular, because of the sort of the strange nature of this session, staff was not prepared to be able to brief the committee on legislative matters. And so we sought to cancel the meeting and schedule something for later. I think right now the next meeting is scheduled for November 5th. We do have a new staff person, Cece, Seikau, who's our Senior Manager of Power Resources Contracts and Settlements. Cece is joining the team, focusing on managing the long-term contracts that we have entered into and will be entering into. Prior to EBC, Cece was responsible for a similar role at PG&E, focused on their renewable power purchase agreements. Also worked to operationalize their first electric vehicle rebate program. Cece has an MBA and an undergrad degree actually from UC Berkeley. So Cece is a double Cal and lives in the city of Berkeley. So we have a real commitment to that community. I know
we have Bears.
A number of Cal alums on our board. So that, the background that should be. Can you go to the next page? I am having an issue right now loading the board meeting site. So I can only see the strange. Okay.
Seeing a memo here.
Yeah, yeah. So the next thing I want to share is we are planning to issue a request for offers for a variety of different renewable and clean energy projects. Our target release date for the RFO is the October-November timeframe. And, you know, we're going to be seeking, you know, larger projects in size. You know, this RFO will be somewhat similar to the RFO that we issued about 2 years ago, if you recall. We issued an RFO for renewables projects, and we ended up procuring 550 megawatts of wind and solar and energy storage from that effort. And so that will be coming, and you know, I expect that we'll start to see some of the results and some of the project opportunities in spring. So that will be something that we'll be continually updating the board about, and we're very excited for. On to our marketing and account services update. Annie, are you going to join us, or shall I jump in?
I am here, Nick. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Now you're muted. There you go.
I have separate audio and video. I've got a little feedback. So we just wanted to provide an update on the joint rate mailer and the power content label. So the joint rate mailer did go out at the end of August. And excuse me. Apologies. It did go out at the end of August, and we were able to use both email and regular mail to get that out. We didn't see any significant changes in enrollment, such as opt-outs, though we did see a small spike in our opt-ups. The power content label is typically sent out before October 1st each year. For a variety of reasons, the California Energy Commission has pushed that back until the very end of the year. And we can't send it out before they provide a template, which includes the California power content. So it is not just PG&E or any one utility or one CCA, but everybody all wrapped up. And that is part of the template. So they intend to issue that template sometime in September. And then we've been discussing internally what is the best timing for sending that out, realizing that there will be a lot of mailers and a lot of info being thrown at people. Election. Additionally, we have been doing a lot of outreach and engagement with our new communities in Tracy, Newark, and Pleasanton. They have all now received sort of an initial marketing education outreach plan. And I believe we are nearly complete in scheduling presentations to the entire city councils within those member jurisdictions so that we can further. We have also asked them to start to think about what they want their default product to be if it is not the right choice, and that will be coming back to the board sort of in line with other product decisions before the end of the year. And then lastly is we have continued to do our local sponsorships. So these are relatively small dollar amounts, but to help support our local community, build relationships, and really have another avenue to reach out to our customers. So we do this three times a year, and we just provided a list here, which I believe continues onto the second page of the recipients of those local sponsorships. And that's it for me.
Thank you, Annie. So that is all I have to share for the CEO report.
Not a bad thing, Nick.
Thank you. Did anybody have any questions? I see Mary Sutter, then Mike Hannon, then Nick Pilch. Mary?
Good Great, thank you. Hey, Nick, I just had a quick question on under the RFO updates. What's the difference between a shaped energy product and an indexed energy product?
Shaped is, so generally when we buy renewables, we buy them as available. So when the sun shines or the wind blows, a shaped product would be one that, you know, has a defined delivery term. So I'm going to deliver this at 4 p.m., 5 p.m., and 6 p.m. So shaped would be sort of, it has a delivery shape to it. So that's a shaped product. Indexed is the pricing. So generally our renewables contracts will have a fixed price. So $25, $30, $15 a megawatt hour. But that includes both the energy and the environmental attribute. An index would be you pay a fixed quantity for only the attribute, and you don't pay for the energy. And the rationale of an index transaction is your counterpart, so the project owner believes that they can trade on the energy at, you know, in a way that they can do better for themselves than if they were to fix their energy revenue. So they think, all right, I believe I can, over the 25 years, generate more energy revenue than that $25. So I'm willing to take more risk and, then take on that reward. And so what they're effectively doing is just fixing the energy price at a lower level and taking more market risk over time.
Thank you.
Okay, Mike?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Annie, thank you for the report. I greatly appreciate it. I just want to focus on that last comment regarding the new jurisdictions where it was indicated that marketing and outreach plans have been provided to each city. Could you advise me when were those provided and in what form did they materialize?
Sorry about that. I would have to go back to tell you the specific date. I would say it was within the last few weeks, and those would have been delivered via email. And I can follow up with you and make certain that you get the exact materials, and I can provide the date of which they were provided.
Thank you, Annie. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And Nick Pilch.
Yes, thanks, Chair. And Annie, would those have come from your email address or from someone else? I'm also interested in that as well.
So those went only to our new member cities. They did not
go
to the existing members. Yeah, it was talking about sort of what we're going to do for the new enrollment outreach. And those would have come from Alex DiGiorgio, just for further clarification.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. So my question is, when the marketing, regulatory, and legislative meeting was canceled, we did talk about doing the legislative update. I thought it was at this meeting, although I'm not sure I see it on the agenda. I could be wrong. Nick, do you intend to do a leg update now or at the next executive meeting or at the next board meeting? What's the timing there?
We were, you're right. I did indicate that we would put it on this agenda, but you know, then upon further discussion with Melissa, she felt like there still is a lot going on, especially as we're waiting for bills to be signed. So, her recommendation was to try to actually schedule, an marketing, regulatory, and legislative meeting in October. And that would be the time to sort of give the legislative update.
Okay, thank you for that. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Oh,
and I believe a doodle poll will be going out shortly.
Okay, thank you. And then if I know that there was a crazy session, but there are some bills that did head to the governor's desk for signing. So please do let us know as a board if there are any bills that are in front of the governor that we want to have signed or don't want to have signed, let us know so we can send the appropriate action. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, any more comments from board members? Do we have any, did we already ask for comments from attendees on the CEO report?
We have no speakers for the CEO report.
Okay, and these are all informational items, correct?
Yes, the okay. CEO report's informational.
Okay, colleagues, I'd like us to go straight to the, I'm sorry, hold on a second. I'll just bring it up, my apologies. Straight to item 15. The Brilliant 100 options information. This is an informational item, but I know there's a lot of interest among the public, so I'd like to go straight to that. Also wanted to let you know that at around 6:30, I will have to drop off for about 45 minutes. Director Martinez and our CEO is already aware of that, but I'd like us to get to this item right now. So Nick, do we have a staff report on item 15?
Yes, we do.
Okay, let's go straight to that.
Annie, are you ready? Annie will be giving this stuff.
I am ready. We have a presentation, so we can go straight to the presentation. Stephanie, shall I share my screen or will you pull it up?
I will pull it up in just a moment. It logged me out, so I'm logging back into the SharePoint.
Okay, thank you very much. So I will just get started and speak to the slides that'll come up shortly. And these are all posted to the website. We did make a recent update as we got some more information at the beginning of this week after these were posted last week. So I'll make sure to include that in what I state here, but just know that the updated materials are also available online. So to start off with, we're here to talk about what are we gonna do with Brilliant 100 in 2021. And just if we could go to the next slide, quick reminder on where Brilliant 100 stands right now. So we have decided, the board has decided that for the 2020 calendar year, the power mix would be 33% of RPS qualified renewables, which is as required by the state, and then 67% carbon-free power. And that would not include a nuclear allocation that had been previously offered by PG&E, so it would be all large hydro. We would continue in this calendar year to offer that at parity to PG&E rates. But as a reminder, you know, we have discussed with the board multiple times that the cost to serve Brilliant 100 is actually lower, or I'm sorry, higher than the current rate that is being paid by our customers. Could we please go to the next slide? So in June, the board decided to keep basically the product as is for the rest of this calendar year, with the exception that it would be unavailable to new accounts or opt-ups. So basically new customers as of July 1st of this year would not have Brilliant 100 as an option. That has already been put in place. And so customers can no longer select that as an option when they opt up. The power content for Brilliant 100 was set at the RPS. So if we do continue it forward, next year, it would be 35.8% RPS, and then the remainder carbon-free. The board also, or staff had informed the board when we met and made this decision in June, that we would come back in September to further discuss it and present some options. Next slide, please. So here are those options now. First is to offer Brilliant 100 at a premium cost, but keep it at 100% carbon-free with no nuclear power. And that premium we have set as a range of anywhere from 2 to 5% over PG&E rates. And I'll speak to that range a bit more in the next slide. The second option is to simply close the product. It just wouldn't be offered anymore. We would have to transition the current customers on Brilliant 100 to another option. You know, the recommendation at this point would be simply to move them onto Bright Choice. But we acknowledge that both Hayward and Albany have the majority of their customers on Brilliant 100 currently. So clearly there needs to be decisions made around that if the board was to choose to close the product. And of course, Piedmont also has a default on the Brilliant 100 for their residential customers that are on CARE or FARA. It is a much smaller population. Then a third option is being presented tonight at the request of two cities that we received formal letters from. The city of Pleasanton and the city of Hayward have sent letters in and are attached now to the materials posted on the website, indicating that they would like for it to remain an option that the board considers for a third product, which would be 100% carbon-free at cost parity. But we would do so, we would be able to do this financially by accepting the nuclear power allocation from PG&E. Go to the next slide, please. So that raised a lot of questions about, well, what is the carbon-free allocation in 2021? The previous regulatory proceeding did not have an allocation being offered in 2021. But PG&E at the very end of August actually submitted an advice letter to the California Public Utilities Commission requesting that they be allowed to offer this, be able to offer a carbon-free allocation to the same parties that they offered it to last time. They want, so this would be both nuclear and large hydro. They want to do this for the years 21, 22, and 23. They also asked the commission to make a decision by October 31st. However, the letter did not indicate the size of an allocation or, you know, what that would be per load serving entity or what that split might be between nuclear and hydro. We've seen some forecasts perhaps, but we don't have those specific numbers. And then just as a reminder, as we talk about a potential carbon-free allocation acceptance from PG&E, we did recently discuss this, and at the April board meeting, the board did vote to accept only the large hydro allocation and not accept the nuclear allocation from PG&E. Next slide. So there's a lot of questions that come up about when we talk about Brilliant 100 at a premium. Top question is, of course, well, if that's a premium and Renewable 100 is a premium, how do they compare? How does it compare to PG&E? How does it compare to Bright Choice? So I'm not going to walk over every number here on this slide, but it is a reference so that you have a sense of what a 2% premium would look like with Brilliant 100. Notably on the right-hand side of this chart, I've compared the cost above PG&E on a monthly basis for a Brilliant 100 customer and a Renewable 100 customer. I also, if you, by row, it's for sort of a standard residential, small commercial, and large commercial to show the difference. So, you know, minimal difference at residential, increasing as you get to our larger consumers. And then the last two columns on the right are the difference between Brilliant 100 and Renewable 100 on a monthly and annual basis. Next slide, please. And this slide's just gonna, it's the same information, but now with a 5% premium. So you can see that the cost of a PG&E, of course, increases, but the differential between Brilliant 100 and Renewable 100 is smaller. Next slide, please. So there are a number of reasons why we present this range. The first being that, you know, PG&E typically changes their rates once a year. That's typically in January. That has not been the case for the last couple of years. There have been delays in making sort of that calendar year's initial change, and then there's been multiple changes to generation rate, which is fairly uncommon. There has also been changes to the power charge and difference adjustment, the PCIA, which also has an impact on what we charge for our generation rate. So given that, we don't know what the prices are going to be in 2021. The next forecast is published by PG&E in November. But they don't actually provide the final, if there is a rate change January 1, they don't provide it until December 31st. Therefore, if the generation rates are higher, it means that, you know, our cost to serve Brilliant 100, we looked at that load and looked at our forecasts and looked at the market prices, you know, that cost isn't gonna change much within our forecast. It doesn't, that cost doesn't have anything to do with PG&E rates. But when we set the pricing and we talk about a premium, that is associated with PG&E. So if PG&E generation rates are higher, our premium might be smaller because we only need a little bit more to cover the costs. If the rates are lower, the premium might be higher in order to cover our costs. The second consideration in reasons for a range is the uncertainty over the potential carbon-free allocation. Even putting nuclear aside, forget about that third product, if the board chooses, like it did in April of this year, to accept the large hydro allocation from PG&E, that means we get that power, quote unquote, for free. And we don't know how much that's going to be. And so if we get a sizable allocation, the premium will be smaller. If it's a smaller allocation, the premium will be higher. And then the next slide simply shows, okay, what if we did away with Brilliant 100 altogether? What would customer choice look like in terms of the cost from a billing perspective? Next slide, please. So here is a proposed timeline. Staff is bringing this item to the board for discussion at this board meeting. In October, we have already begun our outreach to city staff, particularly those cities that do have a majority of their customers on the Brilliant 100 product. But we ask that the jurisdictions, their city councils or various committees, begin to discuss this in October about, you know, what they want to do. In October, the board would vote on which of those options they would like to move forward with, and potentially voting on pricing. I say potentially because, again, it would be better if we had some more information before we set the premium, but I think that's part of the feedback we're looking for the board for tonight. In November, it would be decisions by local jurisdictions on what local product changes they would like to request. We would be presenting an outreach plan about any potential changes. And then we've been in weekly conversations with city staff from Hayward and Albany, and they would like to, if possible, they have these things scheduled for, I believe it's the November city council meetings, sort of in the first half of November. If everything can be decided at the city council level in time, we as EBCE staff would bring that to the board and request that the board make a decision whether or not to approve the decisions of the city on which products they want to offer. And the reason that we pushed this to November rather than December is that the city staff would like additional time to do outreach to local constituents and local customers. So in December, the board would vote to approve any product defaults or changes. And then in January, we would, as staff, be implementing whatever decisions had been made in those previous months. I will just make a small note here that many of your jurisdictions have selected Brilliant 100 for your municipal accounts. We have been talking with city staff about this. Ideally, we would know if you wanted to change that your municipal account product. We would know that, you know, in December, early December. But that is something that can come. It doesn't require board approval, so that could come later if necessary. But it's something for, I think, your local staff and local councils to be thinking about as well. And that is the end of the presentation.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. And just a reminder, today is an informational This is an informational report and a discussion, both for the public and for us as board members representing the public. And to Annie and Nick, remind us again, maybe you just said this a moment ago, this will come back to us for a decision at a later meeting this year. Is that right?
Yes, likely in October.
I'm sorry?
In October.
Okay, so that's next month. All right, great. Okay, so if there are some crucial questions that someone wants to ask now, that's fine. But I do want to get to the members of the public. So if there are some burning questions that you feel people should hear the answers to, Let's do that now. Otherwise, we'll wait to have a board discussion after the public engages. I see hands up. I see Nick Pilch and Jesse Arigian. Nick?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Of course, this affects our city, and I have not been in touch. I'd been previously in touch before the August recess with staff about this, and they were concerned. I haven't been in touch with them lately, so I will talk with them as soon as possible after this meeting. But I certainly know our jurisdiction appreciates the Brilliant 100 product. And so my question was, am I hearing you right that the cities who choose Brilliant 100 could choose a nuclear allocation, but the nuclear allocation would not affect the other cities? Or is the proposal that the board would have to vote to take a nuclear allocation in order for us to keep price parity? I'm talking about the third option now. In order for us to keep the price parity with Brilliant 100, if you could just clarify that again for me, hopefully my question was clear as well.
Yes. Annie, I was letting Annie respond, but I'm happy to. So the acceptance of the allocation under this scenario, the option three would be one where it would only be allocated to the Brilliant 100 accounts in those cities where the council has voted to accept the allocation. Any excess nuclear would be sold. So if you are in a city where your customers have not accepted nuclear, there would be no nuclear from the allocation in their mix.
Okay. Thank you. That's my only question at the time. I might have some more comments after you hear public. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Mayor again.
Thank you. Well, we had a lot of discussion about this for many months, and the board did vote to say that we were not going to accept the nuclear allocation. I know that there was some difference of opinion about that, but that was a decision of a majority of this board. I certainly respect the right of local jurisdictions if they want to include nuclear in their power mix to do so. But my question is, it sounds like we have to accept the whole thing, and those jurisdictions that want it can take it, and those that don't, we have it and we have to sell it. Would this appear on the power content label for EBCE for all other jurisdictions?
Annie, it's sort of there's some nuance to the answer. So Annie, why don't you start?
Sure, absolutely. So to reiterate what Nick said about this being in some jurisdictions and not others, I think a nice way to describe it is it would be its own unique product. So if the board chose to no longer offer the current Brilliant 100. Then each jurisdiction would say they would choose which of the Bright Choice, Renewable 100, and this third product they wanted offered to their customers. So we would be able to set up the systems in such a way that if a customer called up and used the automated system, or they went onto the web to opt up, that they would only see the options that had been approved by the local council or county board to be offered within that jurisdiction. That being said, our power content label has to show all of the products that we offer. And so yes, it would show up on the power content label as this one unique product having nuclear content. We can also, within that product content label, indicate which jurisdiction that product is serving.
I just think this is an end run around decision this board has made. I know not everyone was on board with the outcome, but we had a lot of discussion about this. At the end of the day, a majority of the board said, no, we didn't want to accept the nuclear allocation. And the practical effect is what the ratepayer is going to see is that we have nuclear. So I just think it's important to put that out there for our consideration. I respect the decision of Hayward, if they want to do this, to do that, but it is going to mean that when ratepayers in Berkeley or Albany or those jurisdictions, like the other jurisdictions, didn't vote for nuclear, see their power content label, it's going to say that we have nuclear as part of our power content.
Okay, thank you for those comments. And no other burning comments. We'll have time after the public speaks for us as board members to discuss this again. Again, there's no decision to be made tonight. So Madam Clerk, please, do we know how many speakers we have for this item from the public? And if you're a member, if you're an attendee, you're welcome to raise your hand if you haven't submitted anything in advance. And remind me, the phone raise hand is *9 or *6? What is that?
It is #9.
#9. Okay. Either the hand raise or the #9, or any other previously submitted speaker card.
Thank you. And I have 5 speakers for this item.
Okay. So that's fine. Let's start calling them now.
Okay. Ingrid Treyup, you have access to your microphone.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this is Igor Tregub. I'm speaking in my capacity as the chair of the Sierra Club Northern Alameda County Group and someone who has been interfacing with you fairly extensively on CCA issues. The Sierra Club is also part of the East Bay Clean Power Alliance. And speaking for myself, but also for these groups that we represent, I have a number of concerns regarding this proposal, and many of them have actually just been stated by Mayor Arreguin. The board has already made a decision, and this seems to be an end run attempt around that decision. I'd like to reiterate that what we're asking is for real local clean energy to create community benefits like clean energy jobs, community wealth, affordability, and continuing to fight climate change with community needs at the center. This and other proposals are just continued ways for PG&E to perpetuate attempts to dump its unwanted nuclear energy on community choice programs. I understand that the fight to get a more equitable PCIA has not gone in our favor, and we're committed to working alongside of you to fight for a more equitable one. But we're not sure that this is the solution. In fact, we believe it's not. And we look forward to working alongside of you to come up with solutions that actually give consumers the choice to make decisions that collectively result in getting energy from cleaner, renewable sources. That is what the customer base signed up for. That was the truth in the advertising when EBCE was born. And we hope that you continue to respect the will of consumers that include that go well beyond just 2 cities that include a number of jurisdictions throughout Alameda County. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you. And next speaker, please. Who's that? Madam Clerk, who's next?
Sorry, I'm muted. Melissa Yu.
Welcome.
Hi, hi, council members, members of the board of EBCE. My comments are very similar to Igor. I'm also with the Sierra Club, and we are very displeased. I'm not going to repeat some of the comments that Igor has already made, but I think that his comments and Mayor Arreguin's comments are very spot on from the beginning, from the get-go of when this program started up. We worked together to create a program that really gave us consumers a choice to choose where our electricity comes from. And we want clean electricity. And from the beginning, we did not even want this third product, this third Brilliant 100 product. No other CCA has a product like this. Nuclear energy, I'm not going to repeat these comments that have been made in previous meetings, nuclear energy is not clean, and accepting any type of nuclear energy would be a betrayal of community trust, and it would just be crazy for any marketing that the program has to do, and it would be very difficult on our end as an organization to keep advocating for a program and call it clean if it has nuclear in the power mix. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. And our next speaker is
Jessica Tovar.
Hi, everyone. Jessica Tovar, East Bay Clean Power Alliance. Needless to say, everybody is really upset to hear that East Bay Community Energy, even though 64 people spoke against accepting nuclear into our community choice program, that you would consider it again. And pretty much, I think it's pretty clear that this is the same issue being spun in a different way, and it feels really conniving, actually. The whole point of having a community choice program was to offer cleaner energy and be able to do local development in our communities. East Bay Community Energy has been setting a precedent for other communities of how to do community choice the right way. And with the consideration of nuclear now again, seems to be shooting itself in the foot and not best representing the community and their wants for the type of energy they want to power their communities. We know that you can do better. This is the opportunity and the time to do better. Skirting environmental justice is not the way to address climate change. It's not the way that we want to power our communities. We do not want to lock the next generation or more into nuclear energy. That has no place in a clean energy future. I really hope that you do the right thing and represent the people who have spoken for months, and especially in April earlier this year. No nuclear in East Bay Community Energy. Thank you.
Barbara Stebbins.
So, you know, we really see the compelling issue that comes before the board in terms of city choice. You want to be able to support cities in their efforts to meet their climate action goals. And if possible, if there were a way to do this and truly isolate the nuclear, then maybe that might be something to consider. But there is not. The way this will work, PG&E, if they get permission from the PUC, they will send, you know, an offer letter of the amount of nuclear that EBCE would be allocated. If EBCE accepts that allocation, they have to take all of it. They can't just tailor it to the cities who are asking to include nuclear. And as Jesse Aragain asked and Annie pointed out, it will be on the power content label for EBCE. So what it means in the end is that EBCE power mix will include nuclear. This is the battle we just did, was to keep nuclear out of EBC's power mix. We'll try and update you on what other CCAs did, but the majority rejected the nuclear. A few of them even put into their JPAs now that nuclear is a forbidden product that they will not accept nuclear ever. And I might point out as well that nuclear is only going to be an option for a couple more years in any case. So it's really will impact this agency and its reputation in an extremely negative way if an actual proposal to accept the nuclear allocation comes out of this request. I think, as others have said, we need to find ways to help local jurisdictions get to real GHG free with local clean energy resources, including energy efficiency, including local microgrids and generation and power storage. And that is where the future lies, that it will be truly resilient and also really sustainable. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Looks like we have a couple more here.
Jada Dumas-Dogan, you have access to your microphone.
Hi, thanks, Stephanie. Jada Dumas-Dogan again with Local Clean Energy Alliance. I'm very disappointed that we're here again talking about nuclear, although the board already voted against accepting nuclear allocations after hearing from more than 60 community members who said no to nuclear in April. And even more inspired by our organizing efforts in the East Bay, communities in Sonoma County and Monterey Bay convinced their board members to reject PG&E's nuclear allocation. Also, when we checked last time, as Barbara mentioned, 8 CCAs in the PG&E service area rejected nuclear. And also it was revealed at the Community Advisory Committee meeting on Monday that EBC will need to agree to buy whatever allotment made available from PG&E, and it's not possible for EBC to limit the size of that allotment. CEO Chesed claimed that the agency could always sell any extra nuclear, but Clean Power SF staff reported that they found no such market existed after investigating a similar proposal. And also when EBC staff brought this issue to the agenda for the first time, I remember that council member Dan Kelp asked the question whether it would be possible to accept the nuclear allocation and then sell it. And I remember CEO Chesed himself responding by saying that it would be very difficult. He even said that EBC may need to pay someone to take it. To sum up, 8 CCAs already rejected the nuclear allocation and PG&E has to sell its excess nuclear in the market. CEO Chesed already told us in the past that EBC may need to pay to get rid of nuclear, and there's a staff member from Clean Power SF telling us that they didn't find any market for nuclear. So my question is, what will happen if EBC cannot sell the nuclear? I think saying yes to the third option is saying yes to nuclear in EBC, and I hope you won't do that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And we have one or two more speakers.
Yes, I have two more speakers. Alita Dupree.
Thank you, Chair Dan Kalb. Alita Dupree for the record. My pronouns are she and her. Before I get into the subject matter here, I came to meeting late and I had some trouble getting in because we didn't have a link in on the front page of the website where I could access this meeting in progress. So I had to go into history, get the Zoom code. But anyway, concerning this matter of the Brilliant 100, which it looks like we're on, I'm not going to take a hard or antagonistic stance about this. And I mean, public power is public. And ultimately, you as a governing board answer to the people of your jurisdictions. I am concerned about the nuclear possible nuclear acceptance. And I know this is information, and I knew that it was going to come back up because the previous action you took was for a limited time. It was not permanent. And I can understand the need to have a value proposition because for many people, they're very price sensitive to electricity. I would rather that we not take any nuclear for a few reasons. One is our brand, and that I am of the understanding that accepting nuclear, if we couldn't get dispose of it, could reflect on the power content label. Now, of course, if a person wanted to avoid that, they could choose a product. that would not have nuclear in its mix. And I do see that all the time with other utility enterprises that offer different kinds of products. I do think, though, that if nobody is willing to purchase nuclear, then perhaps that might be something that will help hasten the retirement of the Diablo Canyon power plant. And I've seen it with coal plant retirements, that if people, if enterprises don't want to buy the coal-fired power, eventually the owners of a coal-fired power plant have to take it offline. So I think in the global long-term perspective, we should not have nuclear in our mix, because I think it certainly can complicate things going forward. But I do respect the decisions of the cities and towns that have oversight of this agency. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I have one more speaker, Michael Eisenscher.
Thank you. Good evening. I'll be very brief. I want to associate myself with the criticisms that have been offered by other speakers in the Clean Power Alliance. I want you to contemplate for the moment how you will explain to your grandchildren and great-grandchildren the legacy that you will leave them by perpetuating what is not a sustainable or clean source of power, and which in fact is a pollutant that will endure for centuries. Secondly, it seems to me that this is a power play behind the scenes by the nuclear industry that wants to preserve the opportunity to come back and sell you small nuclear plants that they claim are super clean and able to endure all of the criticisms that they've been encountering with their super large generating plants. This is a camel's nose under the tent. I urge you to reject it. It's not in the best interests of the people of the Bay Area. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, speakers. Appreciate all the information. And again, the timeline for making a decision is at our next board meeting, which will be, Nick?
And I think one point here that is important to note, when we think about the timeline for making the decision, the timeline, I think fundamentally the timeline is about what to do with Bright Brilliant 100, irrespective of whether or not the option three is adopted. I think that that's obviously been a major area of discussion. But the core issue that we've been talking about for some months now is if Brilliant 100, again, putting the nuclear allocation aside, if Brilliant 100 must be more expensive, say 2 to 5% more expensive than PG&E's rates, should we continue to offer that as a rate for our customers? Or do we want to eliminate Brilliant 100 and just offer two rates instead of having one that's Bright Choice, which is less expensive, and one is Renewable 100 that's more expensive, as opposed to having two rates that are more expensive than PG&E? And so, I think that's, when we think about the timeline here and why we need to make a decision by October, the decision is really about what to do with Brilliant 100 from a pricing perspective, because we have to go into 2021. If indeed we're going to say close Brilliant 100, then, we should be aware of that, and we need to communicate. The cities of Hayward and Albany in particular need to determine what they want to do for their customers who are on Brilliant 100. If indeed we decide to keep Brilliant 100 open, but say at a 2 to 5% premium, well, then they also still need to make a decision, those two cities, about whether or not they want to keep those as their default rates. And, does the city of Hayward want to keep their customers on a default rate that is potentially more expensive than PG&E? So I know that most of the discussion here in the public comment has been focused on option three around the nuclear allocation. And, given everything that, has gone on and all the debate about that topic at EDC and generally, that that certainly makes sense. But I do want to sort of focus on, at least from staff's perspective, the direction we need is more about the view of the board around offering Brilliant 100 as a premium product or not. If it's not a premium, if it is a premium product, should we close it or should we continue to offer it, but recognizing that it's going to be at a couple percent premium to PG&E?
Okay, thank you for that. Colleagues, directors, I see some hands in the queue. Anybody else who wants to say a few words at this point, being reminded, of course, that this is not the decision-making date, but sharing all your thoughts now where everybody could hear them all at once, it would make a lot of sense since we cannot do that between now and the next meeting given the Brown Act. So I see Councilmember Mandel from Hayward, and then Nick Pilch after that, and then Ed Hernandez after that.
Thank you, Chair. So few thoughts. First, thank you to Alita Dupree for correctly pointing out that the April 2020 decision was for 2020. It was a 6-month decision. It was not a permanent decision. So there's no revisiting here. This is kind of a different question. This is about 2021. Second, to Mr. Chassid's question about, you know, should we continue Brilliant 100 as a premium product? My answer is, and I've said this many times before for many months now, is a firm no, because the core promise of Brilliant 100 was that it was 100% greenhouse gas free at the same price as PG&E. That was the elevator speech, right? That's how we sold it. That's how it was described in Hayward. Certainly that's how EBCE described it. And to break either of those two core tenets of that rate structure fundamentally breaks the rate structure. And so we have to either keep it at the same price and 100% greenhouse gas free or get rid of it altogether. Now, I'm really hoping we can keep it because just Monday, I was at a sustainability committee meeting where they showed, you know, Hayward has a goal of reducing greenhouse gases 20% below 2005 levels by 2020. And we were like 16% below in 2017, 21% below in 2018, 25% below in 2019 because of Brilliant 100. We're trying to save the planet. It is a climate damn emergency, as the governor so eloquently put it, and we're trying to respond to that. And Brilliant 100 is helping us to do that. And Hayward is not a wealthy community. We can't afford to, you know, just put everyone onto, you know, Renewable 100 at like an 8 to 10% premium. But we can afford to charge the same price as PG&E for a clean product from a climate change perspective. Now, I respect that other cities may want to make different choices. I personally think that Bright Choice is a really poor product. And I mean, no offense, and I'm sorry to put it quite so bluntly, but it's 50% natural gas. From a climate change perspective, it is horrible. It is dirtier than PG&E. I'm embarrassed by that. I would not allow that in Hayward if I can prevent it. But I respect your city's rights to make a different choice than mine. We are a community choice aggregator. I respect your community's rights to choose a cheaper product, even if it is worse for the environment than PG&E. I would ask that all of you respect Hayward's and Pleasanton's and perhaps some other communities' right to choose a greenhouse gas-free product that we can afford. It's okay if we make slightly different choices on our defaults. That's okay. But we should support each other's rights to make those choices. You know, I pointed out last time that if we buy more natural gas, and that's the choice, that's what Bright Choice does, that the natural gas plant in Hayward will run more and pollute more and cause more children in Hayward to develop asthma. Highest level of asthma anywhere in the county, with I think maybe one other exception in South Oakland, is in South Hayward, right near that power plant. I don't want to make that worse. The people in Hayward loathe that power plant. We want it shut down. We certainly don't want to be sending money to it and buying power from it. That is an abomination to us. We would like a different choice, please. The last point I'll make is that Brilliant 100 with mostly, you know, or half nuclear or whatever, it will cost the same price to EBC to procure it as Bright Choice does. So the buying of the power will be the same for EBCE as Bright Choice, but we're going to charge a little bit more, which means that Brilliant 100 is actually more profitable to EBCE than Bright Choice, more excess revenue that can be plowed back into local development or building up reserves or whatever. I'm okay with that. But what Hayward really wants is a greenhouse gas-free option that isn't a 10% premium. Please consider trying to find a way to offer that to us. Thank you.
Okay, let's see, Director Pilch.
Thank you, Chair. And I very much appreciate my colleague, Director Mandel's comments. And I think I agree 100% with what he has said so far. So I have a couple of questions for staff first, hopefully quick, and then I get on to my comments. Question, didn't the power content label that just came out show nuclear power in the mix for Bright Choice?
Yes, it did. A small amount of nuclear power from the ACS that had been purchased.
Okay, and we can talk about why that is more, but I've discussed this with staff before. And then finally, our second question for staff, can you speak to the issue of selling the nuclear as was brought up by some of the members of the public? What is your best guess at this point about our selling nuclear if we take the allocation?
So my expectation would be if the board were to direct us to pursue the allocation, we would seek to condition that on being able to enter into a sale transaction ahead of time. So if we're not able to sell, then we would not take the allocation. And that's what, I think at earlier meetings, when I spoke to the ability to sell, I think that was, we do not expect to be able to generate really any significant revenue from a transaction where we shift the nuclear. But the indications we've had from multiple parties is that at a price of zero or very close to zero, there are other entities in the state who would take that excess nuclear and green their mix as a result. But I think that's how we would have to do it, is we would set, say, a forecast of load for the jurisdictions that intend to be served by Brilliant 100, or not Brilliant 100. Let's actually consider this a new product. I'm not gonna name it. Unnamed product that has carbon-free that has nuclear in it. We would develop a forecast of load, and then we'd ensure there's some buffer. And so we would say, let's say that load reflects 70% of the expected allocation of nuclear. We would then, before accepting it, we would go out and enter into a sale transaction for 40% of our allocation, ensuring that there's a 10% buffer in there. So even if it produces a little bit more or loads are a little bit less, there's no scenario where it bleeds into other communities. So there are ways we can do it. And again, I think if we couldn't sell it, we would want that to be something the board knows ahead of finalizing any allocation.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chassa. Thank you. And that's very smart. And once again, I want to thank staff for bringing smart choices in front of us, or a wide range of choices that we can pick. And I also want to thank the jurisdictions of Hayward and Pleasanton for sending the letters and asking for this choice. So I voted against the nuclear allocation back in April.
But I come from a very strong environmental background. I've been in Sierra Club leadership, Sierra Club elected leadership, and I'm applying for that again. These are my peeps. Local Clean Energy Alliance, I agree with almost everything that they advocate for. But I ask you all to keep your minds open. I have always thought very pragmatically about the nuclear allocation. I do not believe, and I have seen no evidence, that the acceptance of the nuclear allocation would cause a market for nuclear energy or cause Diablo Canyon to produce more energy, nor have I seen any evidence that it would shut down earlier if we don't accept the nuclear allocation. For the reasons that Director Mandel stated, my community is still very interested in this price parity, bringing 100 product, and one of the big reasons we chose it was, again, it was for the same reason Hayward did, to meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals. So I don't know if we can push a higher price product on our constituents. So I have to represent my people as a council member and currently this year as a mayor. I have to do what's right for my city. So I don't, there's more discussions I need to have with my staff, with the advocates in the city. We have a climate action coalition. We have a climate action coalition. We have a sustainability committee and at the city as well. I want to talk to all those folks and see what they say. So I'm not sure what I want to be, exactly what I want to be advocating for, pushing for at this point, but I please ask you to keep your minds open. I think this product at a price parity with PG&E is a very interesting, very creative, very important product for our city. So I'll leave it at that for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm gonna say a few words myself right now, and then I'm then gonna turn it over to Director Martinez to chair the meeting for another 45 minutes. We're all at home right now. I want to say a couple things. One, of course, we're not making a decision tonight, so a lot for all of us to think about. As Nick mentioned, that our ultimate decision, or a big part of the decision, is do we want to continue with the Brilliant 100 in one form or another, which would, in one scenario, be a more expensive product than the PG&E base rate, and would that be something we would want to actually have, given that we already have a renewable 100? And then how does that impact the local jurisdictions? And also, as I think was mentioned, many local jurisdictions have opted up to Brilliant 100 for their own city's accounts. And so if that price is going up, how does that impact the city's budget? Maybe not a whole lot, but some people want to look into that probably before next month. I want to think about, just in terms of the nuclear question on this, these options here. I know, you know, we have three products that different cities choose, either for them, for their set, or for themselves as a city entity, their city accounts, or in a few cases, for their entire customers or residential customers or what have you. But those choices for individual cities were made after a decision was made by the entire agency, the entire board, to have those choices available. We all voted, or although all of us who are here, we voted to create those three products, and that was the decision we made. And then once that agency-wide decision was made, then people got to choose from within those options. What we're being asked to do today, I don't think is the same thing. I think what we're being asked to do is to provide options for two cities or however many that are not one of the options that the entire agency made available or wanted to make available. So the idea of just choice, there are different ways of looking at choice, and I think we can't ignore, or at least we shouldn't ignore, in my opinion, the countywide agency that we are and the group that we are. And so that's one of the frames I'm looking at this in. I'm happy to think about it more over the next few weeks, but that's one of the thoughts I'm having. So I know next in the queue is Ed Hernandez, but I'm gonna turn this over to Councilmember Martinez. I'm gonna have to step out. I will come back before you're over, but thank you for this discussion.
Thank you, Chair Kalb. Okay, Member Hernandez, go ahead. And while Chair Kalb is out, you only have 20 seconds per person. I'm kidding, go on.
Well, thank you very much for the presentation.
I support that.
I don't want to touch the nuclear option at the moment. I think it's important to maintain three choices and figure out how the Brilliant 100, according to the website, says we have 55% hydroelectric. So we've already chose to take the hydroelectric significant allocation there. Bright Choice is 21%, according to the website. And Renewable has a zero hydro. So knowing that we have this large allocation of hydro, how does that mix into Bright Choice? And so depending on the right elements of, you know, discounts of Bright Choice at 1% below PG&E, do we change that to make Brilliant 100 still on point of on par with PG&E? Or I think looking at a rebranding of a carbon-free 100 could be an option. So I think we have to maintain, in my opinion, three options. And if we have a one-off scenario, I think it'll be up to the board here to choose if we have a special version for select cities. But I'm very supportive of trying to be greener and cleaner in the future and knowing that nuclear is not going to be here forever. But for me, I think I want to understand the financial impact of our forecasted costs. And I know that's very difficult to do so with our energy mix. And I do not want to see additional gas peaker plants come online. And that's my biggest fear. By turning off one thing, we have to go to something that we've had in the past, because you can flip a switch and turn that on. I know we're working real hard and I'm supportive of solar, wind, and hydro, of course, and there's other options. But I think it's very important to keep the three options so that way when you do, like when you go get gas, for those who have gas vehicles, you have the 87, 89, 91. And anytime you want to buy anything at a restaurant, you have a small, medium, and large beverage, most people will go for the medium. So I think the medium option is in the middle price range. So if you do bump it up to maintain it 2 to 5% because we don't want to touch nuclear or we want to change the cost structure of the programs. I mean, I think I see that we need to keep three, but if we're going to try and keep that promise on par with PG&E for Brilliant 100, then we got to look at the cost structure on the other two products. Because I would also like to move up my city to that Brilliant 100, and we're going through our climate action plan now. I think this is one element that I will push to move up the ladder of cleaner and greener energy for the city of San Leandro. I think that's all I have, and I appreciate the member comments so far. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Member Hernandez. Next, we've got Member Penton from Pleasanton.
Thank you. New kid on the block. We're not even selling any PBC energy in Pleasanton yet. We waited to join the agency. We were convinced a year ago that this was the right time and that everything was moving along swimmingly with the idea that we would have three choices for our residents. One, a parity product that's as clean as PG&E. Bright Choice if people wanted to save 1.5% or so. And of course, if those who wanted to do the right thing by the environment, the Renewable 100. I know our city, and we're hopefully to convince our corporate neighbors to pursue Renewable 100. We had planned on this project with on these products with the our CAP 2.0 that we're just starting now. So what we're looking at, if we don't have Brilliant 100 to choose from, we're looking at a less cleaner, 1% less product for Bright Choice, or convincing our residents to opt in with a much more expensive but cleaner product. And I just don't think that's what we bought a year ago. That's what we were concerned about 3 years ago. And so our request here, we would prefer if you gave us the continue 100% carbon free without nuclear power for a Brilliant Choice on parity. We'd love to do that. We're not going to get that now. So that's why we've requested, well, then put us in with nuclear power for now, knowing it'll go away in 2024, and that we'll have more renewables, and we'll maybe be able to repackage these products. And then at the same time, if I have to convince my residents in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, that they need to move up to this new brilliant 100 at 2% or 5% more, I think we can do that. But we're entry level coming in April next year. And so I ask everyone to consider our request. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Member Monroe from Livermore.
Right. So I spoke fairly strongly in favor of keeping nuclear in the mix several months ago. And part of that is because my city would likely take that third option. So as representing an individual city, making a guess as to where my city would go, and for reasons already stated by Director Mendel, you know, that would be an option I would hope to keep on the table. That said, I think that there is a preliminary question that we haven't really considered, which is how bound are we as individual cities with these discussions? You know, how does this organization feel about individual cities acting individually in what cases? We haven't considered that, and that is the question that Director Aragon raises. I don't think that we actually have an answer for that. So maybe we need to consider that first. One more thing, which is that Director Penton said, there's a gap here. And I feel that as well. And I'm looking at the Northwest corner of Livermore, where, as Supervisor Haggerty well knows, there are requests for solar farms there. So I'm looking at what solar farms, you know, I wanted to stay pretty agnostic on whether I want a solar farm there or not. That's another story, and it's the county's decision. But I am looking at how well those solar farms, should they materialize, would provide energy. And we have storage problems, and we have generation problems. I am concerned with going carbon free. Climate dam emergency, let's, you know, all together. So I would like to keep the three options, and I would hope that we can think about a way for each of us, you know, for this organization as a whole, to think about what the constraints are for individual cities, the opportunities and constraints for individual cities.
Okay, thank you, Member Monroe. Next up, we have Mayor Aragon.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the discussion, and I want to respect the decisions that different communities are making. I understand that people want to get to a much higher level of greenhouse gas content. I guess as part of this conversation, and this really gets the fundamental question about are we going to continue Brilliant 100, and if so, at what level of power content? And there are budgetary implications. I recall that we had this conversation in April when we voted on the nuclear question. And I guess I would be interested in understanding, as part of this conversation, if we wanted to keep Brilliant 100 at parity with PG&E, we would have to pick up that additional cost. What would that cost the agency? So that information can be provided to the board as part of the deliberations for around this particular issue. I think that'd be helpful. And it may be that we decide that that's not worth it and that we want to look at other options. But I totally understand the concern about trying to have as carbon-free of an option as possible, particularly given the fires and poor air quality that we're all experiencing in the Bay Area. If the board does move in this direction, and I have a lot of concern. Honestly, I was a bit surprised when I heard this presentation tonight, after the many months of deliberation you had on this issue. I would really hope that we would have a conversation on how to make it very clear that those communities that aren't electing nuclear do not have nuclear as part of their power content. Because I don't want to hold, my city's a nuclear-free community. That's a decision the voters made in 1986. And I don't want a whole bunch of people in Berkeley to start all of a sudden opting out of EBCE because they're mad that their power content label says nuclear. I don't think the agency wants that either. So I think that's something we have to very seriously consider as well. And that was, I think, one of the reasons why a number of directors decided not to accept the nuclear allocation, was the impact and the harm to the agency and our reputation and our ability to retain customers. Lastly, I will say that my community has been interested in opting up to Brilliant 100 for some time, and maybe even Renewable 100. And we've had a lot of conversations with EBC staff about this. And I just hope whatever my community decides, that you will respect that decision as well. So I understand the desires and the concerns. I think we need some more information around the cost benefit of keeping it at parity with PG&E versus other options, so that we can make an informed decision next month. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Aragin. Next up, we have Mary Sutter.
Thank you, Director Martinez. Let me get my video going here as well. So, I view your CAC as a group of folks who can come and provide you some advice from the community. And I think that the different conversations that we've had today represent what we heard as well at the CAC. At the CAC, we take a motion and action to advise. So we had a motion to not support or include a third rate option, this third rate that has been discussed about. Our community was split. We had a null vote. We had three people for, three people against. And the reasons for and the reasons against were all the ones that you've heard already. And I think that, really that, no support for nuclear in any format, in any project was for, and also kind of understanding that this pandemic has caused issues for revenue for the local governments, yet the local governments continue to have greenhouse gas goals that need to be met. And I think that other members of the board here have presented that more eloquently than I just did. But we recognize that. So we as a CAC really have little to offer this month anyway. We're going to revisit it next month, so we may have something else to say at that point. And we heard from the public exact same things that you heard from the public. So, there was pretty much consternation that this was coming up as well. But I do remember thinking we were kicking the can down the road a little bit, because the choice was to have no nuclear through 2020. We knew that this choice was going to come up again at some point. The other thing that I wanted to mention, and I'm going to support, I can't remember which director said it, is we asked staff, is there any possible product that could be at parity, could be greenhouse gas free, and doesn't include nuclear? And very possible not. But they got creative with this. I don't know if there's any other creativity to be had. It just may not be possible. But that was the other thing that the CAC kind of has to offer to this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Next, we have Member Hannon from Newark.
Thank you very much. I'm not going to repeat a lot of the comments from my colleagues, but we would have sent in a letter of support for an option three as well, as articulated by Board Member Penton. We're new to the program. We certainly want to give our residents the most and as many options as possible. We certainly want to make sure that we're environmentally friendly here in Newark as well, but we're also sensitive not only to the environmental impact, but the economic impact to our residents as well. Many of our residents are unemployed or underemployed, and certainly by going to 100% renewable product, that's going to certainly pose a financial impact on our residents as well. So we would have supported an option three as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Hannon. I don't see any other hands raised from our committee. And I will just add my comments that I hope staff heard that it would be helpful to dig in financially to what the cost would be if we were to eat the cost of keeping the product. I do think this is a very complex issue. There are, I think, moral issues, there are safety issues to consider, there are greenhouse gas issues to consider, but the financial issues are nothing to sneeze at the moment. And I, for one, would like to keep an open mind as we move into the next month. I know I need to go back to meet with my staff and get the temperature of my city because we're in a different situation than we were even 3 months ago. So that's where we're at. And if there's no further discussion, I'll just reiterate, this is an information item and it will be coming back in October for further discussion. So with that, I'm going to move back to the agenda. And I believe Chair Kalb skipped around just a bit. So we need to rewind a bit to go back to item 13, which is the Community Advisory Committee report. So Mary, if you're still on with us, if you're prepared to give that.
It'll be very short. The only report that I have that you haven't heard is that we're strongly urging the executive committee to agendize the discussion of CAC appointment update policy that's happening on the 25th. Your CAC is down to 6 members. We have no vacancy. We have no people in the vacant for backups, no alternates, that's the word I'm thinking of. And we've lost folks over time just based upon the attrition. So we are possibly not going to have quorums for a while. So we know it can take a while. I know I have been in contact with Stephanie about the updates. They seem reasonable to me. They seem good. I'm hoping that they're agendized. We want to see them back at the CAC because I know the CAC is interested in seeing kind of what the updates to the current policy are. But we are hoping that we can move forward on this and getting folks appointed with all speed. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Madam Clerk, do we have any comment on this item?
There are no comments on this item, but I would also like to note for the record that Councilmember Jaime Patino has joined. He joined during item 15.
Okay, welcome, Member Patino. Does staff want to respond to the CAC request? Are we going to be seeing that on our executive board agenda?
Yes, so I am trying to schedule a call with an ad hoc committee of the board to discuss the comments before we present them to the executive committee. But if it's fine with the executive committee with us moving forward with the recommendations we have and presenting them for the first time to the board at the executive committee, we can do that as well.
I'm sorry, can you?
Sorry. So we have written out the recommendation of what updates we would like to make to the CAC guide. They're small, they're not controversial. Mainly it is assigning seats to member cities as groups so that the board members are engaged with the appointment, as well as shortening terms to allow CAC members to revisit in 2 years versus 4 years. We would still maintain the full appointment terms of 8 years, so they'd still be eligible for 8 years on the CAC. Those are some of the minimum ones, and then discussing anything else we can address to ensure that we have the geographical diversity and representation we need on the CAC.
Right. And were we planning on having us take that up at the next executive board meeting, or were you saying that you wanted to bring that to the next board meeting directly?
We wanted to bring that to this executive committee meeting, but prior to that, speak with an ad hoc committee of board members.
Okay.
We have been working to schedule the ad hoc meeting, but you know, there's a lot going on for all of you. So I think if we are not able to schedule the ad hoc meeting prior to the executive meeting, these updates to the CAC guidelines to the executive committee for discussion, and that will potentially replace the ad hoc committee if we're not able to schedule the ad hoc committee.
Okay, understood. Thank you. Okay, moving us along, we have next the, we have item 14, which is the CEO Employment Agreement Amendment and Bonus Consideration. We are actually striking the amendment and bringing that back next month to make sure it comports with everyone's, with the board's desired needs. For the bonus consideration, well, first of all, is there any public comment for this, Madam Clerk?
Do not have public comment on this item.
Okay. Well, in that case, I am going to take a point of privilege and move to award the CEO with a 3.5% bonus, which is just the remainder of the bonus that he was eligible for on his last contract. We, as a board, decided to delay consideration of the balance of this bonus after the advent of COVID and wanting to understand more about the financial impacts of COVID-19 on the agency. And I think at this point, we are able to reconsider whether or not we can fulfill that bonus that we had included in our CEO's previous contract. So I'm gonna go ahead and make that motion
myself,
and I am looking for a second.
Second.
And so we have a motion by myself and a second by the director Haggerty from Alameda County. And is there any discussion? All right, I don't see any hands raised. I'm sorry, did someone say something?
I just said it was a good idea.
Okay, thank you, Member Monroe. Madam Clerk, please call the roll.
Albany?
Yes.
Berkeley?
Yes.
Dublin?
Yes.
Fremont?
Yes.
Hayward?
Yes.
Livermore?
Yes.
Newark?
Yes.
Pleasanton?
Yes.
San Leandro? Tracy?
Yes.
Alameda County?
Yes.
Emeryville?
Yes.
Thank you. Motion passes.
What about Union City?
Oh, Union City. I apologize, yes. Director Patino.
Thank yes.
you. Thank you, Member Patino, for speaking up. Okay, that moves us on to item 16. This is the prepay overview and approval of council. So do I have a presentation on this from staff?
Yes. Stephanie, would you mind pulling that up? While she does that, I'll just introduce the topic. So this is an action item where we are seeking approval of a resolution authorizing the CEO to negotiate and execute a consulting services agreements with two law firms, that's Ora, Carrington, and Sutcliffe, for the roles of bond counsel and tax counsel for an amount not to exceed $400,000. And the second law firm is Chapman and Cutler, and that's for the roles of disclosure counsel and issuers counsel for an amount not to exceed $235,000. This presentation, I'll provide an overview of what the energy prepay structure is. I'll detail a little bit of what the various council roles are that we're seeking enabling agreements for, and then give you a status update on where we are at in terms of the overall process and diligence of the structure and negotiating documents. So, Stephanie, can you move forward? The one thing I'll emphasize is today the action is purely to execute enabling agreements for the legal counsel. It's not an approval on the structure itself. The structure and the document preparation and diligence will take probably 3 to 6 months as a rough indication. And so we would take another item forward to the board prior to actually executing on the structure for formal approval. With that said, this is a financial structure, so there are some complicated details here, and so we will definitely be revisiting this item in the coming months to make sure that there's more education with various board members to ensure proper understanding of what we're presenting here. So this is really just an introduction of sorts. With that said, I'll dive into the presentation. The energy prepay structure itself is typically a 30-year term. And in it are involved a few different parties. There's, of course, a tax-exempt load-serving entity, in this case, of course, EBCE, but other municipal utilities throughout the country would be other sort of eligible candidates for a structure like this. And then there's typically a prepay supplier, so usually a bank or a large financial institution that is a taxable financial counterparty that would help structure the overall kind of arrangement. And in it, what we're really doing is creating a structure, a financial sort of vehicle whereby we as a tax-exempt load-serving entity are able to assign in various commodities contracts, for example, a long-term renewable energy PPA.
And typically that PPA would be financed with some form of taxable debt. And so by assigning it into this structure, we are able to take advantage of our tax exempt status, do a debt raise, and basically get a discount on our PPA that is equivalent to the, that is based off of the spread between the taxable and the tax exempt debt rates. That's the concept, and we can talk through the sort of the details of how that sort of structure works. But that's the that's the main point that I really want to communicate in terms of what the structure actually is sort of executing on. The benefits, as I noted, typically this is a 30-year term, and the estimated discount is somewhere between 8% and 12% of our current power costs on whatever contract we actually assign into this vehicle. The risks that I would highlight, of course, there are some regulatory risks that we're continuing to evaluate. We've done a good amount of diligence already, but we'll continue to do that to ensure that we continue to comply with all the various energy procurement requirements in the state of California related to, say, SB 350, which is related to the long-term contracts that we have in place, things related to emissions performance standards. So we will here that we are properly diligencing, and we'll certainly close that out and mitigate that risk as we go forward. Next slide, please. The couple other key details to highlight. One is that this is a non-recourse financial transaction. Of course, that's very critical. We are not looking to put on a significant bond onto our balance sheet. The overall size of the bond that we're talking about here is in the range of $350 to $850 million over the 30-year period. That's a pretty significant range. What determines that range and where we go out to market are a couple things. One is just to understand the appetite for bonds like this in the state of California amongst investors. And the other, of course, is our appetite to assign certain commodities transactions that can flow through a structure like this. I'll say thirdly, which is important to note, is we are looking to execute on this transaction jointly with Silicon Valley Community Energy. So it would be a shared notional value between the two of us. That's just to help sort of assist in properly diligencing the structure and sort of spreading out some of the costs associated with this transaction. The last point I'll make is that this, what we're talking about here is basically enabled through U.S. tax law. So it's very well codified in U.S. tax law, and it's been applied to natural gas prepays for a couple of decades now. So I'll touch on some of those stats going forward, but there are significant volume of natural gas prepays that have been executed. And what we're talking about doing here is really applying that same concept to electricity prepays, and in our case, most likely renewable energy prepays or large hydro commodities contracts. So trying to take the same tax-exempt benefits that have been applied to natural gas and applying them to our electricity contracts. But it is a somewhat newer application with that said. Next slide, please. I think I've actually touched on most of these things, though I will highlight that whatever contract that we elect to sign into this type of a vehicle, I just want to note all of our obligations really continue to remain. It is a limited assignment of delivery of energy and payment of energy that gets put into this structure. Really, all of the, what the board has approved us with in terms of our long-term renewable PPAs, all of that performance obligation, both from the buyer and the seller, remain intact. And so that is unchanged from this sort of structure. And the other point, which I've already noted, but is worth emphasizing, is the debt is non-recourse and it's off balance sheet for EBC. So while the bond size is a very significant notional value, what we're talking about doing and the nature of the structure that we're recommending here with a financial institution allows us to do all of that debt financing off balance sheet. And so we are not absorbing the sort of the credit risk of such a significant bond financing. Next slide, please. This is a picture of boxes and arrows of the structure itself. Again, I'll reiterate, we will definitely continue to bring forth this structure to the board in the future and make sure that there's more and more education, because I know this is, the financial aspects of this are not necessarily in the everyday purview of our board here. But let me just touch on sort of the basic mechanics here. On the right side, you have LSE's load serving entity, and obviously in this case, it's EVCE, or jointly with us, Silicon Valley. That's that box. And there is a PPA that we have currently existing, and really a number of various commodity contracts can be applicable here, but I'm just highlighting, say, a long-term renewable PPA. And then on the left side, you have a prepaid supplier. And in this case, we've actually been working with Morgan Stanley as the counterparty that we selected through an RFP process. So they are the large financial institution that we are anticipating to work with. We would assign the PPA contract. So that's sort of the dotted arrow over to the prepay supplier. And then they would actually perform on the limited assignment that we would make. In the middle is a green box called municipal conduit. And there are various municipal conduits in the market today that basically issue bonds on behalf of load serving entities. We are anticipating actually putting together a municipal conduit to represent CCAs, though we don't have to do that. And I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. But the middle is basically the conduit vehicle that actually issues a tax-exempt bond. And you can see that sort of in terms of the debt service and the proceeds arrows there. And then what happens is basically a prepay supplier, they are paying for certain megawatt hours and renewable energy that we have assigned over through that PPA. And then of course the contract place is an obligation that prepay supplier has. But really through that is, as I noted, it's a limited assignment. So as the load serving entity, we still have every obligation to perform under that PPA. So what happens there is we still have an obligation to pay. We pay a discount on our PPA. We receive the same megawatt hours and renewable energy that we would have otherwise received if there were no assignment into this vehicle. And we receive a discount there. Again, that discount is because there is a spread between the taxable and the tax-exempt debt rates. And so this vehicle allows a monetization process that applies that discount for us. And the financial institution is able to utilize the cash through their treasury group that basically allows for that discount to us. Perfect, next slide. Market statistics, I just wanted to highlight, in terms of the natural gas prepays that have been done here and some of the limited electricity related prepays, there have been 90 plus municipal transactions nationwide, and that's represents $50 billion plus of combined notional value. In California, there've been over 10 transactions done and close to $6 billion in notional value. You can see a lot of reputable financial institutions that have been in the market with this transaction, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, RBC, Citi, Bank of America. So we did run a solicitation that looked at all the prepay suppliers out there. And in that process is where we selected Morgan Stanley based off of their experience on prepay transactions, as well as their experience in the commodity side of the business. I think I've touched on that last bullet there. So next slide. This is a detail on the council role specific. So as a reminder, the specific action we're asking for here is approval to authorize the CEO to negotiate and execute contracts for our bond council, tax council, issuers council, and disclosure council. So the first four council positions, those are the council roles that really the load serving entity are responsible for selecting. That will allow us to actually move forward with Morgan Stanley, actually negotiate documentation to really flesh out the details of the structure itself and how we want to move forward. Legal counsel is pretty instrumental in that aspect, since there's a lot of tax implications here for how to ensure that the structure itself is adequate. So the bond counsel represents bondholders, tax counsel provides a tax opinion on the transaction, which is pretty critical given the nature of this type of a structure. Issuer counsel really represents our interests, so the CCA interests, the load serving entity interests, and the disclosure counsel really presents the overall offering document related to the bond. As a reminder, ORIC is the law firm that we're recommending for the bond and tax counsel roles. Often those are coupled together, and then Chapman and Cullors, who are recommended for the issuer's counsel and the disclosure counsel. The underwriter's counsel is something that the bank would choose. Next slide. And then actually go one more beyond that. So just a quick status update sort of where we are in the overall process. So at this stage, we ran an RFP to sort of select these two law firms, Orrick as well as Chapman, and hence we are bringing those forward to sign enabling agreements. We also ran an RFP to select Morgan Stanley to understand the different financial institutions that are out there that perform these types of services. And as I noted, we are looking to do this as a joint transaction with Silicon Valley Clean Energy in order to sort of mitigate some of the risk associated with us doing this as a first transaction, and diligence the effort together and sharing some of the notional values in order to get to an optimal bond size. Last two points I'll make is that, say, TBD are the bond issuer. So that's the conduit aspect that I mentioned before. We are exploring doing a, actually flip to the next slide, please. So we are exploring creating a municipal bond conduit, or I should say bond issuance conduit ourselves. The reason to do so really is to save costs. There are existing bond issuance conduits out there in the market. They're pretty simple structures to actually put together, but they're expensive. And so it is more cost effective to actually work amongst a group of CCAs. You can see the list here represented Marin Clean Energy, ourselves, Silicon Valley, and then Central Coast Community Energy, which is formerly Monterey Bay Community Power. We are looking to form an issuance conduit, and with that, it would be formed as a JPA. It would be a fairly administrative conduit vehicle, basically to issue the bond out of, and then there would be certain sort of voting requirements amongst the CCAs. And so that is something that we are endeavoring on right now to form. Again, there's no obligation to do that. If for some reason we don't meet an agreement and put in place an agreement that works, we can always go out to market and use one of the existing conduits out there. And then the last thing that was open is a municipal advisor. So we have an active solicitation right now to select a municipal financial advisor to assist in this process with us. So a number of parties related to this overall transaction. Next slide, please. On the timeline, so in September, why we're bringing this item forward is to get the enabling agreements in place with council. We have the issuer advisor RFP out there right now. And then we want to begin, with getting the enabling documents in place with council, we want to begin negotiations with Morgan Stanley more fully on the actual documentation. October to December is where I would envision we would line up the commodities transaction that we would want to assign into a vehicle like this, as well as get all those documentation in place. I noted before, it's a 3 to 6 month timeframe that we actually envision executing on this transaction. What dictates that is really, timing of markets. Right now, the spread between taxable and tax-exempt spreads are not there, not optimal to actually execute on a transaction like this. Things like this tend to be cyclical. It is a recessionary environment right now due to COVID, so now's not the right time to do it. But now is the time to get your documents in order, get your ducks in a row, so that when markets do sort of revert, we are ready to go and can sort of optimize when we go out to market. So I say 3 to 6 month timeframe is when we would probably execute on this, but it's very much so up in the air based off of debt rates, basically, which are very difficult to predict. The other factor that impacts timing is we need to get some assignment consents for our various commodity contracts. I don't envision significant risk there, but still have to go and get those various consents in place to ensure that we can assign the contracts that we want to do. Next slide, please, and then actually flip one more. So financial impact. The fees associated with the various council positions are laid out here. So it is up to $400,000 for the bond council and tax council role, and it is up to $235,000 for the issuers council and disclosure council role. I say up to because these can be structured as either contingent fees, where the fees are fully paid out of the proceeds of the prepaid transaction. And there's a good chance that's what we would move forward with here. But alternatively, there is an opportunity to consider non-contingent fees. I think what we are seeking approval for here today really is the up to $400,000 and the up to $235,000 amounts. So a total of $635,000 for council fees. And then lastly, really just the summary here. This has been an overall summary of the, Stephanie, can you go to the last slide, please? So, I provide a very quick overview of what the structure is itself, and happy to answer questions, of course, and we'll continue to revisit the structure itself and make sure to properly educate on some of those details. But today, what we're asking for is authorization to move forward with a resolution that allows the CEO to negotiate and execute consulting services agreements with Orrick, Harrington and Sutcliffe, and Chapman and Cutler. So I know I spoke quickly there, but I will stop and ask for questions now.
Great, thank you, Howard. I thought that was just the right amount of explanation for our first time digging into a complicated financial instrument. So now would be the time for clarifying questions. I see one hand raised. Member Hernandez from San Leandro, are you ready to ask your question?
Thanks again for passing the information to the Finance Committee that one time. Rather complicated vehicle. I understand it's one of the first times we might issue this kind of conduit to take some opportunities there between the structure of a tax-free or not. But the one thing that caught my attention is in the structure of the timeline, going back to that slide, can you advise or inform me more about the issuance of getting the RFP for the financial advisor? Is that something that normally you would do first before you tie in counsel and commit to over $500,000 and then also the JPA? With Marine Clean Energy, East Bay, of course, Silicon Valley, and Central Coast. Trying to understand what would you sort of recommend to see the right steps forward? Because we want to look at a financial advisor first before we commit to counsel, even before we have a JPA. So I think those are sort of my three questions. Any clarity on now after the second time hearing this presentation?
Absolutely. Good question. So we worked with an advisor actually in the RFP process in the selection of Morgan Stanley, just to make sure that you're aware of that. So that was not something that we did independently. We did that jointly with Silicon Valley, and then we also worked with a financial advisor called PFM. They were an advisor that we utilized when we negotiated our credit facility as well. We felt it prudent to issue a separate RFP specifically seeking services for the overall transaction negotiation. I think that was sort of advised to us based off of looking at what we did for the RFP advisor aspects and then the full issuance sort of advisor role. So, at this stage, I think we have the RFP out there. It's active, and it's going to be about a 3-week turnaround time to sort of award that advisor. And I would suspect in October, my expectations we will bring forward another action item to formally enable with that advisor. But I just want to, I guess, give you the assurance that we have utilized the advisor already in the past to select Morgan Stanley and do the initial diligence. And now we're talking about sort of the next phase of things where we are still wanting to close out a formal process there.
And should we not wait those 3 weeks to see what that new financial advisor, it could be Morgan Stanley or some other entity that might recommend a different flow
of the process? Let me just clarify. So Morgan Stanley is not the financial advisor. They are the prepay supplier and they are the financial institution. So we did a competitive solicitation to select Morgan Stanley. That's completed and done. What we're talking about is an independent, objective, third-party financial advisor, which is what the issue advisor RFP is. And maybe that's a little bit mischaracterized, but it is a financial advisor that we have an RFP out there for now.
Yeah, because I think I've worked before another role on the Fair Board with PFM. And just understanding what that universe looks like. And in the language, it said solicitation on our packet, but it was RFP that you went out on both of those, bound counsel, the tax counsel, and disclosure, all the lawyers. So I think you went to RFP, not just solicitation, like here's a short list. Or did you really have an extensive list of who's out there here in Alameda County and maybe adjacent counties and Tracy, what have you? So is that what you did for that RFP solicitation process? As well.
Now, which role are you referring to? Because there are a number, so I just want to make sure.
All of them. I think there's quite a few, but I just want to understand the scope. I mean, I know that we only touched it once, and it was a deep dive. This was a nice brief summary, but in the finance meeting, it was a deeper dive. So I just want to make sure the second time we maybe ask some clarifying questions.
Yeah, so I would break it down to three categories. There's the prepay supplier, which is really the banks. There is... and that's where we engage with an advisor to actually issue that RFP to be a competitive solicitation amongst sort of the broader financial institution community. And we received a number of proposals in that process, and that's where we selected Morgan Stanley. So I think that was a fairly comprehensive search. And then we did a legal counsel RFP. And that was a more narrow search. It was an open process, but we made sure that we engaged with certain counsel because this is a pretty specialized area. There are not a lot of law firms that actually provide these services. You know, there's three or four that are actually actively, that have done basically the history of these transactions. So we really sought those services from legal counsel. And then on the advisor side, so the financial advisor side, that's where we have a current RFP out there. And again, we've sought services from specific financial advisors, though it is an open process. And I'll just note, again, very, very small universe of advisors that have experience specifically with a prepaid transaction like this.
And so it would be nice to also get more information around these entities that are responding and being awarded the RFPs to know from a social equity perspective, do they do outreach and what's their sort of footprint in the community to be more inclusive and, you know, allow more people to be raised in opportunities like this as a public agency? How do we do that? How do we support that? And how do we sort of hold that accountable to make sure they're in the community and finding opportunities? So making sure we're not only looking at this is what they're going to do, this is going to be the revenue gain, but what are they doing for the community, and that impact would be important for me. Thank you for clarifying these questions. I appreciate it. Thank you, Howard.
Okay, thank you. I think next up we have Member Pilch.
Oh, sorry, I was just going, I didn't have any questions. I was just going to move the item, move the staff recommendation.
Okay, so we have before us a resolution, and this will allow us to enable bond counsel, tax counsel, disclosure counsel, and issuers counsel. Do I have a second before I call for public comment?
I'll second.
Okay, we have a second from Member Monroe from Livermore. And Madam Clerk, do we have any public comment on this item?
We have no public comment on this item.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on this item? I think personally, I'm just going to offer that I think this is a good step. I would like to see from staff what a real dollar value attached to the potential savings, which I read in the report is 8 to 12% on the power delivered under prepay. I also look forward to hearing more about the GPA if we need to form one. But I do think this is a good move, and it looks like we do have a hand up from Member Mandel.
Yeah, thank you, Vice Chair. So just briefly, you know, this did get discussed at length at the Finance Committee, and it is a fairly complicated thing. I think that this preliminary step is okay. I'm going to support the motion, but I wanted to let everyone on the board know that the direction from the Finance Committee was that before, you know, staff comes back to the full board with recommendations to take, you know, the follow-on steps, which will be bigger and commit us to, you know, large amounts of money and things like that. Yeah, we really wanted to dig into this in some detail at the Finance Committee and really vet it and be able to provide, you know, not just a discussion about it, but a recommendation from the Finance Committee to full board, one that has, you know, hopefully unanimous support of the Finance Committee that can hopefully give the rest of you some peace of mind that we looked under the covers and understood it. And, you know, because like I said, it's complicated. So it's going to take a little time, but that's coming next. And hopefully before the October, November meeting, when we consider the bigger action. Is that a fair summary there, Howard?
Absolutely. And we heard that message loud and clear. We know there's more steps here and more communication, more overview that we need to provide. And we'll also make sure to engage with the various council and advisors and prepaid supplier as well through that process to make sure we're providing all the necessary information.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair.
Okay, thank you. And I would be negligent if I didn't call for public comment on this item, as it is an action item. Madam Clerk, are there any pre-submitted comments?
There are no pre-submitted signups.
Okay, and I do not see any hands raised. I'm going to give it 5 seconds. All right, Madam Clerk, please call the roll.
Alameda County?
Yes.
Albany?
Yes.
Berkeley? Dublin?
Yes.
Just a moment, lost my list. Fremont?
Yes.
Hayward?
Yes.
Livermore?
Yes.
Newark?
Yes.
Pleasanton?
Yes.
San Leandro?
Yes.
Tracy?
Yes.
Union City?
Yes.
Emeryville?
Yes.
Thank you. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. That moves us to item 17, which is the August heat wave summary.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm at the fairgrounds and they're going to start locking up soon. And I was wondering, I think we only have one more action item. And I was wondering if we could do that first. I'll stay here as long as I can, but I know they're going to shut me down at some point.
Absolutely. And I've been notified by another member that they're going to need to step out soon as well. So unless there's any objection, I am going to actually move us to our last action item, which is item 19. And then we'll rewind after we're done with this. So this is the resolution to adopt rate stabilization GASB 62 fund. And who's taking this one on?
This is Jason Bartlett. Here we go. Great.
Hi. Hello. Thank you. excuse me just one moment. I just need a second just to be fair.
Did I say it right, GASB?
yeah, sure. whether you say it as initial letters or as the whole word, I think it comes across the same.
Like EPC versus EBC.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
EBC does not exist.
No. Okay. All right, here we go. Okay, thank you. So as Howard noted, I'm Jason Bartlett. I'm the finance manager at East Bay Community Energy. And so what we're talking about here today, what this item is about, is the GASB Rule 62. It allows for the deferral of revenue in one period to then be realized in another. Now, it's very important to understand that this is just an accounting treatment. It's not at all a cash management treatment. But if in a period we have a very strong earnings above what we expect and we get what we would consider to be surplus revenue, thank you for putting it on the slide. We can then defer some of that surplus to be used later in periods that might not be strong and may possibly result in a net negative position. Any deferral in that period would be a reduction in net position for that period, and then any recognition would be an increase in net position during that period. And again, I just want to state, you know, that this is an accounting treatment, so it's really kind of different than the cash management approaches that we use, especially, you know, on the treasurer's report or with as we will see with our reserve funds. Because those are already cash that we've already realized and accrued. Now, the particular benefit of that this approach, as I said, is that it allows strong earnings to support, or strong earning periods to support weaker earning periods. Next slide, please. So this will help. The advantages of this is that it stabilizes short-term variations in the budget. And particularly, it can help prevent the need to enact any rate changes in a particular period. If there is a period in which there's going to be a dramatic shortfall, for example, where revenues are just well below expenses, we can use some of this deferred revenue to bolster that so we don't have to adjust rates. And so this helps preserve the value proposition. It also helps maintain consistency funding for local development programs year over year. As we saw last year, not all of the expenses in LDD or in the local development program were realized in that time period, and so we kind of rolled them over to this time period. This will help make sure that we have that funding available. It also fosters strong financial covenant agreements with counterparties. It sends a message that we're using the right financial tools to keep our budget strong and our net position positive. And again, this, because this is this is a deference of revenues in strong years, it will not negatively affect any ongoing operational performance. It will not affect the budget, or will it affect the cash reserve allocation? Now, to be clear, we're talking about past time periods, not future time periods with deferral. We're talking about deferring from a time period that's already passed. So to tell a little bit about how it works, I think we can go to the next slide. So in our last fiscal year, we're going through the audit now, and it looks like based on the preliminary numbers, the way that they're shaking out is that we're going to have somewhere in the order of $22.5 million surplus net position. That's above what the board approved in June of 2018 for, or 2019 for the 1920 budget. And so our original net surplus was projected at around $60 million. We're preliminary numbers are coming out at about $22 million more than that. Now, these numbers are subject to change with audit confirmation, but this is kind of the preliminary stages of where we're at. So what we're proposing is to defer $12.7 million of that surplus. So we'll still end up with, you know, a substantial amount above our budgeted position of around $10 million. But this sets aside, you know, close to $13 million that can be used for a variety of risk factors that may come up. And so if we can go to the next slide, I can talk about what those might be. In particular, you know, we have $4.4 million of local development expenses that were not spent last year that we have to spend this year. And, you know, this was board approved at the budget meeting in June of this year. This will help ensure, I mean, we're going to spend this money anyway, but this will help ensure that this money does not negatively impact our financial statements or our net position at the end of the year. And so this helps allow the alignment of the revenues and the expenses to be in the same period. We've already collected the money for this $4.4 million in local development spend. We collected it last year. We didn't spend it last year. We have to spend it this year. So it kind of makes sense to roll this over into this year. And so we're recommending more than the $4.4 million because it equals the total of the local development budget. And this will help stabilize that overall budget to ensure that it doesn't impact the rest of our financial statements relative to these costs. And then this can help realize and stabilize the budget in future periods as well. And again, I know this is kind of a complex issue, and what we're asking of the board today is to approve this deferral of $12.7 million, which would be then available to be used in these future periods to stabilize the budget as these other expenses come up. So hopefully that's clear enough. And this is an accounting treatment. I want to stress again, so this will not impact our reserve mechanisms that we will be doing as well with this year. Our cash reserves will still be coming out of that $60 million plus that will be going into our cash reserves. And so this is a deferral rather than a deferral of revenues rather than a separation of cash is what I was trying to get at. So hopefully that's clear as mud, and I'm available if, you know, open it up for questions.
Okay, I've got one question right off the bat. Jason, sure. So does the resolution include in it the direction to go ahead and make that change? moving the those revenues to the next year, the 12.7? So I don't,
yes.
Just at first glance, you point me where in the resolution it says that, but I just don't see it.
You're saying, okay. Your question is, does it actually resolve to also add the revenues to the 2020?
Correct. That's my question. Because what I'm seeing in the resolution is that we're creating the, I'm sorry, my computer's acting up, but that we're creating the ability to do this.
That's right. That's right. And it doesn't give very explicit directions, say it has to be this year, because I think we may want it this year, we may want it in future. So.
Okay. So what's the action that we are contemplating tonight? Is it simply the resolution to go ahead and open the reserve fund for under GASB 62?
So yes. So there are kind of two asks. One is to do that, to allow the staff to open up this deferral action, and the second is to authorize the spend, at least the realization of the $4.4 million for local development spend in this current year.
Okay, and do we need that second part as a motion? Can it all be built into one? How would staff prefer this?
I believe it's all in one motion, but I'm not sure. That might be a question.
I'm just looking at it right now just to make sure we're not missing something. I think really the intent here was to create the fund itself.
Yes.
To put the $12.7 million into that fund.
Okay. I just want to make sure that my colleagues understand that that's what we're doing, because that's not the way that I read the resolution. But okay. we can certainly clarify that tonight. I think it's a smart thing to do. I definitely anything we can do to make 2020 look better. I'm in favor.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I would just note that I am looking at the resolution, and it does at least say, you know, there's the creation of a budget stabilization GASB 62 fund. And then in section four, it refers to deferring revenues. You might not see a 12.7, but it says deferring revenues in an amount not to exceed the local development budget that was set for 2020.
So it wasn't explicit about the number, but it did refer to the action. So thank you very much for clarifying that. If there are any other clarifying questions at this point, I will take them now. I don't see any hands raised on behalf of the board, so I will ask the clerk if there have been any comments submitted on this item.
I have no signups or comments for this item.
Okay, thank you. I do see there is one call-in listener at this time, so I will just remind the public that it's #9 to raise your hand. And I do not see any hands raised. So we will move on to discussion. Is there any one who would like to make any comments on this item before we take a motion? And I see Member Hernandez from San Leandro.
Happy to move the item. Thank you.
I'll second. Hayward.
Okay. Thank you. Got that. Okay. So we have a motion from Member Hernandez and from San Leandro, and a second from Hayward. And I want to recognize Member Sutter for comments.
I just wanted to indicate that this was brought up to the CAC. We discussed it. We have no advice on it, but we did hear that this change would make no difference in the local business development projects in terms of what was available to it. So the CAC felt comfortable with that.
Okay, very well. And then Al, I still see your hand raised. So do you want to make any comments?
No.
Okay, all right. Seeing no more comments, Madam Clerk, could you please call the roll?
Alameda County. Albany.
Wait, did you just call Alameda County?
Yes.
Sorry, I was chewing on ice. I didn't hear it. Yes.
Thank you. Albany?
That's a yes.
Thank you. Berkeley? Dublin?
Yes.
Fremont? Hayward?
Yes.
Livermore?
Yes.
Newark?
Yes.
Pleasanton?
Yes.
San Leandro?
Yes.
Tracy?
Yes.
Union City?
Yes.
Emeryville?
Yes.
Thank you. Motion passes.
Okay, thank you. And that is it for all of our action items tonight. For those of you, if anyone needs to leave, but I hope you will stick around for our short informational items. I know staff will make it worth your while to hear about item 17, which is our August heat wave summary.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mike Susco. I'm on the Power Resources team, and I lead the resource adequacy effort. As we all know, we dealt with a heat wave and subsequent outages in August. So I'll be reviewing what were these events that led to the outages, what was the collective response to right the ship or grid, what was the financial impact to EBC, and what are the improvements needed moving forward. So an introduction slide. Next slide, please. So as we all know, August 14th and 15th, we experienced rolling blackouts across the state. We had up to 4 million customers experiencing an outage. The California ISO, who, as we know, oversee the operation of the grid, they did anticipate higher temps and increased loads. They did provide alerts, some communication, but there was really a confluence of events that created unsustainable grid conditions. So what were these grid conditions? We had a historic heat wave, or really a heat storm, not just here, but across the entire West, which limited import supply. We had a couple unexpected natural gas plants tripping offline. We had material fluctuation in wind output, which was much higher than average. And we had critical shortages on imports, and that's not only due to the heat wave, but a failed CAISO flex ramp test. What that means is CAISO actually failed its own test to show the energy imbalance market. This is the market that it participates in, that it had enough flex capacity as to not lean on other market participants. So without going into too much crazy detail, this effectively limited the CAISO's imports during that critical evening ramp. So with all of this, as the solar gen, inevitably fell off, the grid just couldn't support the extreme demand in the evening ramp, and loads were cut. Next slide, please. So temperatures, high temperatures. So, these are the record-breaking temperatures during the heat wave. And here in this graph, we're only using Oakland and Livermore kind of as bookends, and to keep things a little less busy. Heat waves are typical, right? However, this was essentially a persistent heat storm, record-breaking temperatures, a few of the stats below. August 2020 was the hottest August on record. We had Death Valley hitting 130, the highest recorded temp on Earth since 1931. And even the Bay Area, being a somewhat temperate climate, broke numerous of its own records. Oakland, San Francisco, San Jose, all breaking records. So, in the graph specifically, you can notice kind of the evening peak hours there. Even with the forecast attempts being already high on a few of those days, the actuals actually blew through the forecast in that evening ramp. And just overall actuals came in a lot higher than the already high forecast. So a significant contribution to the blackouts. Next slide, please. So outages. So here's really a look at the events, by day, August 14th and 15th. Not going to spend too much time on the slide, but again, driving that point home that there was no one factor that caused the blackouts. These were multiple rare, unpredictable events. The CAISO did expect increased demand and high temps. They issued orders restricting maintenance operations on power plants. They issued alerts regarding reserve deficiencies. They issued a voluntary call to voluntary reduce consumption, really an all-in approach from a messaging perspective to relieve the strain on the grid. But again, conditions worsened and we had the rolling blackouts. But then August 16th and 17th, still very high temperatures. But really a all hands on deck approach across the state. We were able to avoid outages during those days. We had a reduced peak demand, led by multiple stakeholders, you know, and a lot of help from people of California. So a collective call to action. Next slide, please. What was that call to action? This slide separated into messaging and then demand side and supply side call to action. So on the messaging side, the CPUC issued a letter to all IOUs, PG&E, SCS, EG&E on the 16th, requesting that they pursue aggressive conservation messaging and advertising, and requested that, you know, CCAs do the same. So of course, EBC sent notices to customers on time of use and other rates to lower energy consumption. And then the three agencies did the same during the critical hours. And again, CAISO issuing, you know, alerts and warnings. On the demand side, really some unique actions here from a demand side perspective. The CAISO called on demand response programs. EBC is contracted with a DR provider that was able to deploy all of their resources during those events, you know, contributing to resiliency. And then a really interesting one from the CEC, they coordinated with data centers to move approximately 100 megawatts of load to backup generation, and then coordinated with the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps to disconnect 22 ships from shore power, actually even moving a submarine base to backup generation, as well as activating several microgrid facilities. And then on the supply side, equally unique actions. The CAISO called on CPM, or Capacity Procurement Mechanism. What that means is procuring additional supply, you know, from the marketplace. These are, of course, additional costs across LSEs, but that did, you know, help out the supply shortage. Department of Water Resources and Metropolitan Water District adjusted water operations. That was about 80 megawatts of gen in the peak hours. And then the CEC working with the city as well as the county of San Francisco to maximize output at Hetch Hetchy. This actually allowed for about 150 megawatts during the peak period. So that was substantial. Next slide. So slide six, financial impacts. So what did this mean for EBCE? You know, and you know, before we tackle maybe the table, let's touch on some of the bullets. So, you know, the revenues during this heat wave, that reconciliation, that's still in process. You know, of course, from the heat wave, we saw increased costs, energy costs, no surprise, right? But there's also increased revenues to offset some of that. You know, the key here is it's, you know, some of that. So our expectation is that, you know, these heat wave days do operate at a loss. Would like to flag the next bullet, especially since I managed that effort. We did meet all of our RA obligations for the year, as well as being compliant with our risk management guidelines and targets. So now moving up to the main table. So our previous slide. This one's a meaty one. So looking at the columns in the main table, you know, hedge coverage, you know, what is that? So how much of our load has been hedged or pre-purchased in months or even years beforehand? And what that means is locking in energy prices at various intervals throughout the year or years, you know, based on our forecasted load. Moving right, next column, we have our load for the day, and then we have energy capacity costs based on our open positions. And then we have hedge performance, how in the money or out of the money the aforementioned fixed price purchase performed. And then lastly, energy costs, just the previous two columns summed up. So below that, you know, July average is a good one to start with. You know, typical kind of month, summer month, this is our expectation. A really good data point to put this all into perspective. 700,000 around per day is kind of our energy capacity cost based on open positions. And then the hedges, you know, as an insurance policy are usually negative, right? They're usually costing us money. We pay a little bit for that insurance. So then August average without the 14th and 19th heat wave days, you know, similar to July, a little higher, a little hotter month, but similar. But then you add in the heat wave dates, right, inclusive of the 14th and 19th, you know, noticeably higher costs, even though the hedges have now turned positive due to the higher prices, which was expected. So then going to the individual days, looking at the hedge column, you know, what happened, right? Where's the 90, 95% hedges? So when you have an unexpected, you know, demand blowout, right? Those 90, 95% hedges that you have below as data points, they plummet, right? The increased load, you know, more of an open position, and now you have increased exposure to the markets, right? You're more unhedged for that day. Again, the next column, energy and capacity costs, they're going to increase because your open positions are larger and prices are naturally higher. You know, the next column, hedge performance, that's kind of the good news, right? Your hedges performed in the money, but they're by nature, they call it maybe wrong way hedges. What I mean by that is when you want them the most, you have the least of them, right? So your load has increased, presumably prices have increased, and you have a larger open position. You know, and then maybe just lastly touching up on, you know, what are the steps forward, right? How much can we realistically mitigate this extreme event risk? You know, it's an interesting question, no easy answer. We'll continue to assess kind of the hedging guidelines. You know, we're constantly tinkering with hedge levels and looking at balancing the cost of hedging and the benefits. But it's certainly a not an easy answer to, you know, it's an interesting question with no easy answer. So I don't know, Howard, if you have anything else to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, I would just emphasize that, you know, where we procured, we were fully compliant. So when you look at July and look at average and August averages, we're in the 90 to 98% range. And our hedge matrix basically specifies, based off of the month of the year, you kind of want to be between 85 to upwards of 100% hedged. And as Mike really emphasized, you know, unfortunately, heat waves are sort of, our hedges are wrong way hedges in light of heat waves, right? When you really want them and you need them, that's where you have less of them relative to your load, as you can see with the hedge coverage percentages. So I think what he's noting is I want to highlight a couple things. One is that this is a fairly outlier fluke event. I mean, obviously heat waves are something you have to plan for. And so you look at your ranges, and in summer months, generally you would want to be more hedged. So you can see in July average, where it being a little bit more mild, we're like 98% hedged. Whereas if in the spring, you're probably more like 85% to 90% hedged because there's not as much risk of blowouts. And so that's what you aim to do. But even being 98% hedged in July, August rolls around, it's a hotter month and you have this blowout week, historical heat wave, and you're 75% hedged. And that's a lot of exposure for our organization. And as a result of that, the likely outcome is some losses for that week, unfortunately. But obviously what we're looking at as a whole is making sure our policy addresses the year, right? And this is a sort of a unique event. And so I think really what this highlights for us is that we want to make sure we can go back and continue to evaluate. And that's one of the reasons why we brought this item to the board, is to make sure that we sort of keep you informed on these are the sort of oddities that occur, and we have to go make sure that our hedge matrices reflect this appropriately. And then the last element that's really critical is we need to remember that PCIA plays into effect too, right? Because higher energy prices in this week, the net result is some losses most likely. But there's an aspect of PCIA where because of there's higher energy costs as a whole, the impact of that is to directionally decrease PCIA for the next year. Now, it's really hard to sort of acutely say like 1 week's worth of activity is going to have this exact impact on PCIA. So it's hard to sort of translate it one for one. But at least directionally, when you have higher energy prices, that the implication is lower PCIA for next year. So it's hard to sort of incorporate that into a hedge matrix to say what is the exact level you want to be to account for extreme events like this. But with more recurrence of heat waves, given climate change and issues, I think we're just going to continue to evaluate and make sure that we're revisiting our hedge matrix and being sophisticated with how we think about that all.
Great, thanks, Howard. Moving on to the next slide. So kind of moving from the financial impacts, this kind of slide just, you know, ties right in. This is the day ahead and real-time graph. Can give us kind of a clearer look on why those energy costs that we saw in the previous slide were so high. So these are essentially the clearing prices on a day ahead and real-time basis for the respective heat wave days. And we really only included the evening ramp, as that's where we saw kind of the largest price spike. So looking at these prices, these are very, very extreme. You know, the bullet there notes that non-peak hours were between $30 and $80. Those are still pretty high. But again, the evening peak hours are in the magnitude of hundreds, which is extremely high. So, you know, operationally, you know, very high level, we schedule our load in the day ahead market, and then we do any kind of touching up, buying or selling in the real time market, based on how load actually comes in. So circling back kind of to the previous slide, the financial impact, you know, for one, we now have to make market purchases for that incremental extra load on the forecast and at those very high day ahead prices, right? So we have extra load due to the heat wave. It's unhedged, and we have to now purchase that at the what you see in the red bars. And then another aspect, the real-time aspect, is that for however much our forecasted load is off on the day of or in real time, we have to purchase to cover that difference at those very high real-time prices. So it just kind of gives you a sense of what, you know, what we were faced with on those heat wave days. Next slide, please. And then, you know, this graph is really the final piece. You know, we discussed the financial results, as well as the clearing prices for day ahead real time. Now, this is really the load forecasting versus the actual load. And in general, you know, you want your load to be as accurate as possible. It doesn't guarantee lowest costs. You know, for example, you saw in the previous slide, the day ahead pricing was very, very high, right? So you have to purchase at those high prices, even though if your forecast is 100% accurate, but really to lower your volatility. And then, you know, for planning purposes, judicious planning purposes, and really just to be a good actor and a CAISO grid participant, you want your load to be accurate. And you can see here, you know, loads, you know, way above a normalized weather day. But, you know, we actually forecasted pretty well. You know, during peak hours, demand was up to 50% higher than normal. And definitely have to shout out the load forecasting team, the internal load forecasting team, as well as we have an outside vendor that, you know, did a great job, even in this significant heat wave. Next slide, please. So for our final slide, you know, what are the future system and regulatory actions to improve reliability, right? So some of these things are things that EBC will be looking to address, you know, mostly CAISO, CPUC, CEC. They'll be coordinating to take a, you know, a hard look at, you know, overall supply, resiliency, and reliability. So a big one is new peak demand forecasts that can be used in the RA program. So hopefully the CEC will, you know, expand their demand forecasting process to include scenarios like this that try and capture these extreme weather events. They also may develop a more aggregate statewide view of obligations and available resources. The CAISO will continue to further enable DER and load flexibility. And then a general review of resource capacity assumptions. And what that is, you know, CAISO reviewing assumptions regarding intermittent resources, right? And to ensure that those assumptions on capacity are accurate, because, you know, intermittent resources not showing up when expected on aggregate can contribute to a serious supply shortage. The CPUC had already ordered 3,300 megawatts of new capacity last year to come online by 23 to meet potential shortfalls. EBCE is meeting that obligation. And then, you know, you know, we believe, we as EBC believe, expanding demand response programs will be critical. We'll continue to contract with DR suppliers. You know, we have a EBC resiliency program, installing storage on behind the meter residential housing. You know, and during events like this, during events like these, demand response show that it really was an integral part of, you know, of resiliency and overall reliability. You know, and then finally, increased capacity in the form of, you know, lithium ion, something we'll support, but also considering, you know, short-term gas gen extensions to really support the transition to renewables, right, while still keeping reliability of, you know, utmost importance. So, yeah, no, that was a lot of information. This is the end of the presentation, so thank you. And any questions?
Great. I'm actually going to ask our clerk if there has been any public comment submitted before I go to board questions. So, Stephanie, is anyone submitted?
Yes. I have two speakers, Alita Dupree and Blair Beekman.
Okay, let's have them go ahead.
Okay. Alita, your microphone is unmuted.
Thank you, Vice Chair Martinez and members, Alita Dupree for the record. Very good presentation. This is really the most detailed and transparent presentation I've seen from any utility enterprise anywhere. I appreciate your openness with this. We, the public, can really learn a lot. And my takeaway from this is really just a wake-up call for more renewables and especially more storage, both behind and in front of the meter. And also a call for time of use incentive pricing. And I lived through this. I was not in the state at the time. But being in the West, I was still certainly impacted by it. And I had time of use pricing for part of the day, which I was able to cut back demand by using a swamp cooler. But then I went to less expensive pricing after 7 o'clock and thus turned on the AC. By refraining from cooking and other heat producing situations, leaving the hot water heater off, I was able to keep my house demand down to 2.5 kilowatts. But I'm only one person, and all of these things need to be done on a much bigger scale. I am dismayed that it took having to rely very heavily on fossil fuel-based resources, such as disconnecting ships from shore power and putting data centers on backup generation. I support that it had to be done in order to keep the lights on for the public. And even with that, there were days when the public did have to have the lights turned out. So I know that in an extreme situation, we have to go there. But I looked at the CO2 emissions from those days and they were extremely high. So I hope that this year we can involve ourselves more with creating more storage and renewables, so that way when an event like this does come up, we can do more of our part in keeping the lights on and keeping the air clear. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe we have one more public speaker.
A second call for Blair Beekman, and it is #9 to raise your hand. Okay, I do not see Blair Beekman on the attendees list. They may have dropped off.
Okay, that will bring us back to the board. I have Member Pilch. Did you want to comment on this presentation?
Yeah, just a real quick question. With regards to the rolling blackout, there was a mention that a natural gas plant went offline, but
I thought I saw a report today in the paper that that was actually an error, that an error was sent to a plant to go offline when the actual command was something different. And had you heard that information?
Yeah, so on August 14th, the Blythe Energy Center, I believe that's Riverside County, about 500 megawatts went offline 3 p.m. due to plant trouble. And then August 15th, it wasn't an offline trip. It was the Pinoge Energy Center in Fresno, and they essentially ramped down their generation by about 300 megawatts due to a ramp down that was from the CAISO dispatch. That was an error. So that's correct. That's a good flag to correct. But yeah, August 14th was a full trip of around 500, and then August 15th was a few hundred based on erroneous dispatch.
Okay. Thank you. That's all. Sure.
Okay, thank you. And I don't see any other hands raised, so I'll just thank staff for this presentation. And I'm sure we all look forward to seeing how we're going to pivot and react to these events in the future. So that will take us to our last informational item. We have an update on the integrated resource plan.
Yes, thank you.
Hey, Stephanie.
Hi, this is Stephanie Tannenhaus. I'm on the public policy team, and yeah, just providing a very quick status update on EVCE's integrated resource plan process. So we can move to the next slide. So you'll probably recall, especially anyone that was at the July board meeting, EVCE broke our IRP process up into two phases. So phase one was completing all of the requirements that the utility commission sets forth for load serving entities to submit IRPs. And that was due on September 1st. And we have completed that. So in July, the board reviewed the results of that analysis. And then between then and September, we finalized, and that is now publicly available on our website. And I believe was also included in the board package. So that means that we are well into phase two at this point, which is completing some additional analysis that looks at more ambitious greenhouse gas targets than what the CPUC requirements had. And so we'll be finishing that up over the next several weeks, and then returning with the results of that analysis so that we can present to you kind of a comparison of a range of different greenhouse gas targets and IRP portfolios that meet those. Next slide. This is just a reminder that in this cycle of the CPUC's requirements, they required two different portfolios that met different greenhouse gas targets. So the kind of primary reference scenario was a 46 million metric ton scenario. That's statewide electric sector emissions, and then individual targets like for EVCE are assigned based on projected load share in 2030. So that yellow line just shows what those statewide targets mean for EVCE. We can move to the next slide. This is a representation of the long-term resources that were included in our final CPUC compliance portfolios. On the left is the 46 million metric ton scenario, and on the right is the lower 38 million metric ton scenario. The pie charts show the proportion of different resource types that make up our projected long-term portfolio in 2030. So you can see, you know, really high reliance on solar, storage, wind, and then a little bit of hydro and some other renewables in there as well. The resource types are similar across the portfolios, but if you look down at the bar charts, you can see that the lower greenhouse gas scenario to the right does have, you know, higher amounts of resources particularly wind and just, you know, a little bit more renewables to meet that lower greenhouse gas target. But the costs, which are noted in the center column, are only marginally more for these greenhouse gas scenarios, which is, you know, part of the motivation to look at a more ambitious scenario to be able to do a broader comparison of the different trade-offs, costs, and benefits of exploring deeper carbon reductions. Next slide. So the next steps, like I mentioned, we'll be completing the more EVCE specific analysis over the next several weeks and hope to return to you in the next month or so to present the full analysis there. And then we're hoping that this final integrated resource plan can kind of become a resource and help inform future procurement decisions that reach those decarbonization pathways. Thank you. And if there's any questions, happy to answer.
I was not expecting the presentation to be so concise as it is on the IRP, but are there any questions from the board at this point? You all are just IRP experts now because we've been talking about it for so long. So I will check to see if anyone from the public has submitted comment.
Yes, I have one speaker, Alita Dupree.
Okay, Alita, go ahead when your mic is on.
All right, okay. Thank you, Vice Chair Martinez. Alita Dupree for the record. Good short presentation, and I've seen this several times. So again, briefly, I hope we can get this filed soon and continue the work toward a carbon-free and renewable energy-powered EBCE district. As I've said before in various related presentations, I think that renewables and storage need to be the bedrock of this, that even with the intermittency of renewables, that doesn't necessarily have to be taken as a bad thing. So certainly I would support the lower 38 million ton CO2 emission threshold as a means of lowering those emissions across the state. So I think we have a good basic plan here, which will be the beginning of what we can do for future years in continuing to provide a cleaner and greener and less expensive electricity for the EBCE district. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I know I look forward to seeing all of the range of options to take us down that decarbonization pathway. And I'm a very visual learner. So when you said that, Stephanie, I just imagined our very own EBCE Yellow Brick Road, which we're all holding hands and dancing down together. So this is an information item. Thank you so much for updating us on this very important process. I want to thank staff for all of their work on this. Does anyone have any closing comments on this item before we move on? Nope, nobody does. And noting the hour, we should just move along. Are there any board member or staff announcements? And this includes requests to place items on future board agendas.
Chair Martinez, I just have a quick request. This is Councilmember Hernandez from Dublin.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Member Hernandez.
So I know that there is possibly some other organizations that help with vulnerable populations with regards to paying their bill. So instead of just us writing them off, I would like to direct staff, if it's okay with the rest of the directors, to see if there's possible, any programs out there, whether it's at the state or county level, for EBCE to go and look for some funding. So instead of us just writing off, you know, bills that are unpaid because people are having very difficult times through you know, these hardships, just to see if they can do some further investigation to look out for programs.
Was there any particular direction that you wanted to point them in, Member Hernandez?
I would start off at the state to see if there's any funding at the state, possibly. I know that East Bay MUD has some programs. I know that there's other entities that have programs. So it would just be good for staff to like start looking into some other options.
Okay, can I get an appetite from the board on interest on this idea? Thumbs up, thumbs down? Okay, oh, all right. I think I'm seeing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of among those present, I am seeing consent to send staff in this direction. Nick, did you have a question?
More just a response. That makes a lot of sense. We are working with the California Public Utilities Commission and the investor-owned utilities on two programs that would help to achieve this goal. One is the arrearage management plan, in particular, is one that would allow forgiveness of up to $8,000 of customer bills that would not be paid for by EBCE, but would be recovered more broadly. So some of that is in the works.
And Nick, would you just be able to report back in the form of maybe an information item as part of your CEO report at a future meeting?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Member Hernandez, for that suggestion.
Thank you.
Anyone else with comments or future agenda item requests? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to adjourn this meeting. It is 8:12 p.m. and we're adjourning to our next meeting will be October 20th at 5 p.m. And thank you all so much. It's good to see you after our long recess.
Thank you. Bye.